The mood is right. The spirit's up. We're here tonight. And that's enough. The party's on.
720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us this fine evening. Hope you are bundled up and staying warm because it is darn chilly outside. So just stay in. You don't want to go out. It's late. It's cold. Just stay in, snuggled up to your radio or your web browser app or whatever you're doing.
Web browsers are not comfortable to cuddle with.
They're not. And I know that because I often get my laptop and bring it to bed with me and wake up with my face on the keyboard. I've done that many times in my life. And no, they're not. They don't really snuggle back. The laptops, not really at all. Hello, esteemed producer Shane Reardon. How are you?
What's going on?
How are you?
I'm okay. I suffered some laptop snuggling related injuries lately this week while I was home, so I'm recovering from those. But other than that, I'm good.
Are you done with all your shopping?
I haven't really started. Don't tell my girlfriend.
I was gonna say, I can answer that for you because I know that maybe you asked me about something earlier.
Yeah. No, I've started. I've got about half of it done, I'd say. But the majority, I'm waiting to be shipped to me, you know?
Yeah, that's the hard part. You're like, ooh, I just spent more on shipping than the gift because I waited too darn long.
Well, it's not necessarily the price of the shipping, but I work like 80 hours a week between here and the other one, and I just don't have enough time to go out to all these little mom-and-pop shops that you recommended. And I'm trying to do the experience thing.
Sure.
I'm not trying to buy materialistic things.
I think that's an excellent route.
It is. It is. And I'm going to try that. So we'll see.
Good.
Yeah.
After the holidays, we'll talk about what those experiential things were, or off the air.
A trip to Mexico.
I bought a trip
to Mexico. Go to sleep, Rachel.
Yeah. And spoiler alert for the girlfriend there. Good times. And so do you get stressed out about doing the girlfriend gift? I know some couples get really freaked out about, like, early on in the relationship anyway, about,
you know what,
who's spending more, how do we know if it's even, how do we know if it's...
See, that's the hard part, but I've got my mom as a middleman.
Sure.
So I can always go to my mom and say, hey,
I'm getting
what's
this.
Rachel
Am
talking
I,
to you about?
Yeah. Okay.
But her birthday was the 16th of December, so
I think I did
pretty well on that one.
Wow, she really, like, has to... She kind of racks up the loot.
Yeah,
the last
she
half
does.
Of December.
But she's a really good gift giver, and I'm notoriously not.
What makes you a bad gift giver?
Well, it's not necessarily that the gift that I'm giving is bad, but I'm very, you can see right through me. You can see, she knows exactly what I'm getting her.
Oh.
My mom and dad know what I'm getting them. Everybody
so no
knows
surprise.
What I'm
like
getting
you don't
them.
Even need to gift wrap it.
I don't even see what hints I'm dropping. I don't get it. What am I doing wrong? I don't understand.
Why do you think that is?
Because they tell me. They say, oh, I knew that was coming. Well, what did I say?
Well, you left the catalog open there, darling.
Oh, that's it.
Right, it's that.
I share an Amazon login with my entire friend group. They can just log in and see what I'm getting. Yeah.
No, I
don't know. Giving gifts is fun, but I'm not going to be the guy that says getting gifts isn't fun. Of course getting gifts is fun.
Sure.
But giving them is more fun. I'm just not good at it.
You know, I think the key, you have to keep like a running list all year long.
Mm-hmm. God, that's hard.
Keep like put it in a Google Doc or something, or just a little notebook or
sure.
something. I have started because my parents are very hard to shop for because they're the kind of people, they have really specific hobbies that you have to be into that hobby to know what to get them.
Okay.
You know, like I can't just go.
Like tire collecting.
Well, my mom does very particular kinds of sewing.
Okay.
And I know
that's
how
a very
to
mom
sew.
Thing to do.
Yeah, right. And I know how to sew, but she's so advanced at sewing. I would only insult her with like, here's some needles.
Yeah.
She's like, I have those and here's the turbo version. Get the hell out of here.
What are the needle pillows? What do you call
those
things?
The only time I've ever been able to impress her with a sewing related gift, she has a big sewing table in her sewing room. And there is a product that clips onto the side of a sewing table that is a drink holder and coaster so you don't get condensation on the table and on the fabric.
Of course.
And also a little scrap bag so you can cut and then just scrape the crap right into the scrap bag. And it's out of the way. And she loves that.
That would be a good one.
But I already gave her that. So
lose it, Amy, and buy her another one.
Oh, my gosh. Your scrap bag thing is gone.
Where'd
I'll just
go?
Get you another one. Yeah. And then my dad's really into woodworking.
Sure.
It's a very dad thing
easy.
To do.
Buy him some wood.
No. He has very specific types. He has.
Okay.
He wants to buy local, naturally harvested, like trees that were taken down anyway.
So why don't you buy him like a sapling where he can grow this tree, and then when that tree becomes mature enough, cut down the tree and use that tree for the working of wood.
Where were you like a year ago so I could be like, hey, I planted you this tree a year ago?
Yeah. I was living in Logan Square a year ago.
Not talking to me.
I was 22.
Yeah.
No, I think that would be a good
idea. That's a good gift.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's not like you had to plant it a year ago to give him the gift this Christmas. You could just say, here, this is a sapling, grow it.
Yeah.
And then there you go. You're welcome.
Yeah, all right.
Mic drop.
Good. Fine. On that note, now that Shane has solved everyone's gift-giving issues, I suppose I could unleash the fury on you and say, you know what? You gave me such good advice. Everyone, if you call the studio right now, Shane is the one that answers the phone.
I'm sure your first guest, Max Grinnell, would not mind if we got rid of him and just did the entire first hour.
Oh, you don't have to put the callers
of...
on the air. They can just call you and ask for present advice because you're so good at giving it. 312-981-7200.
Okay.
Shane can help you in picking out all your last-minute gifts. He's here to help because he's obviously such a good gift giver.
It's a good thing you're moving time slots, Amy, because you can get away with pretty much anything with me right
whatever
now.
Whatever I want right now. Good times. Good times. All right. As Shane said, we are talking with Max Grinnell, the urbanologist, here in a bit about the history of protest in Chicago. That's been something we've been talking about a whole lot in present day, but I thought we would put it in context a bit and look at the history of it in our fine city. We're also talking with our friend Lisa Dietlin all about philanthropy, especially this time of year. We're thinking about year-end giving. We're thinking about helping people in need. So we're going to talk to her about how to do that in a very smart way and stretch our dollars to help more than we think we can help. And then we're going to close out the show with actor, comedian Kevin Alvis. Very funny guy. Probably, you have probably seen his work somewhere in the city because he does about 10 shows at once. Lots of stuff in store for you tonight, so stick around with you till 2 o'clock. We will be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Okay!
How'd you play that one? We have to get to the hula hoop part. I think that's like a verse away. That might be 10 minutes from now.
No, you need to wait now.
Okay.
Please feel free to go on with radio.
There it is. That's the good part. All right. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Goo. Thanks for being with us tonight. That's a good one. That's a fun song. Everyone loves that one, I suppose. And the Chipmunks just kind of keep going. Every time I look up, there's another ad for another Chipmunk thing happening. I thought that was decades gone. But nonetheless, the Chipmunks franchise continues. All right, my friends, we have a big show for you this evening. But we're kicking things off with our good friend Max Grinnell. You may know of him as The Urbanologist. You can check him out at TheUrbanologist.com and read all about him. He is an expert in all things history, particularly as it pertains to Chicago and Boston, two fine, fine cities. And he's joining us here in studio tonight to talk about something that's been on my mind a lot, and I bet some of yours too. We have, it seems like every time we turn on the news or the radio or anything lately, we see a lot of protests happening, not just in our city, but in the world. There's a lot of things on a lot of people's minds, and a lot of people are speaking out about that, and as well they should in many cases. It's our right to do so, and many people are taking advantage of that right. And so I want to talk about that, but I also wanted to look at that in a historical context, because I think that's kind of where my mind always goes. I don't think anything is just sort of a one-off in our world. I think there's always a bigger picture and things like that. So I wanted to talk all about that, and who better to talk about that than the urbanologist himself? Welcome.
Amy, good to be back. Thank you for having me.
I've only seen you in the studio. I feel like I always run into you. We cross paths here in the studio.
It could happen. Michigan Avenue, River North.
Who knows?
All over the
paths
place.
Paths will be crossed. Right. Well, so you have always brought us such great information on the show, or on this station, rather, about Chicago and particularly you've always talked a lot about travel, which I've always loved. But let's focus just on Chicago tonight, really, because we have such a rich history in this city. And I think, you know, where my mind first goes when I think about any kind of protest, I really think of Haymarket first in 1886. Is that right?
You got it.
Spring
right
1886.
Perfect.
Oh, my gosh. My Google is so fast. and that's a theme we've seen play out again and again, particularly recently, right? I mean, that was about, that had themes of police and excessive use of force, and that had labor themes, and that had a lot of themes that we're still seeing right now.
Yeah, and definitely one of the things, too, as you hint at, is mistrust of different groups, right?
Yeah.
Color people's skins, country of origin.
Yeah.
And this is certainly one of those seminal moments. And, I mean, even the, you know, the folks who had gone, you know, and come back, and, you know, the memorial there was blown up, was moved inside. And, you know, this is kind of part of this, the Chicago history, right? The part of the labor movement, part of this kind of struggle for justice, equality. We've seen it on Michigan Avenue the last few weeks. We've seen it in the Loop. And as you say, it's an important exercise, right? These are people taking to the streets to kind of obtain a measure of social justice. So huzzah to that. I mean, absolutely.
You know, what I always think is really interesting in just over time of covering protests, I've always found it interesting to just kind of pick people out of crowds and say, what has brought you out here today? And in my years of doing that, I've had really mixed answers. Some people have, and I think it depends on where in the line of the protest. If you get up to the front of it and ask someone, you might have I'm a representative of this group, and we are fed up with the following, and we demand the following things. It's a very clear, you know, a very clear question mark attached to the activity. Sometimes towards the back of the line, you sometimes run into answers that are a little vague, that I think there's a sense of belonging, that people want to be part of something bigger. In particular, I'm thinking of in, what was it, 2005 or so, when there was a lot of activity in the Gulf. We had kind of increased our military presence again. There were a lot of protests for several weeks in Chicago, and it was winter, and I remember just a lot of bundled up people. And it, one night there was a protest that led in, up into the front of the Boeing building. And I was asking people there, you know, what brought you out tonight? What were you doing? You know, what about this moves you? And I remember this one young man said, "This is our Vietnam." And I thought, what? Really? I mean, he didn't. I think he just so wanted to be part of something. And that's right. Valid to want to be part of something.
Sure, and perhaps a little bit of hyperbole.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt like it was a bit undermining to the movement, that not that everyone should have a, you know, a speech ready in case some reporter says, "What are you doing out here?"
Effective sound bites.
Yeah, right. Not everyone's going to speak in sound bites, and some people just say, "Hey, I'm angry at what I'm seeing, and I can't really articulate it. I want to go outside and march with people," and that's perfectly valid. But I worry sometimes. You know, I think especially now when we're in a time of email forwards, and I think elections being decided on email forwards and headlines, and not really reading all the facts. That kind of worries me. Does that worry you?
It worries me a little bit too. You want people with a sense of peer purpose, and you think about, I think of too, of the Occupy protests here and in Boston, and kind of, you know, what are people seeking, what's their list of demands? And of course, you know, having been in the city 2+ decades, and with the most recent spate of, you know, police brutality, violence, murder, etc., is what is the long-term solution? And it's really systemic change, and you have to get it embedded.
Which is, you know, so. And I think that's why it's important to look at historical context, really, because as we see from, you know, as we talk about Haymarket, that was some of the same grievances that people have right now.
Absolutely. Right. Working conditions.
Right.
What's the equality of pay? You know,
it's not a one off.
Yeah. It's not
really
a
narrative that keeps repeating. It's just over different triggers, really.
Yeah.
You know,
and when I talk to people about Chicago, you know, outside the city, you know, different regions around the world, and, you know, they, some of this labor history has been effectively erased. You know, some of the people, you know, you and I might know about Haymarket and other historians. But it's something that, you know, what's the first people think about? You know, maybe the Blackhawks or sports or other things, which are great, too. But, you know, what's that kind of meaty stuff? You know, and Haymarket's a great example. We mentioned before we came on Republic Steel strikes of 1937. Even more recent things, march from Union Park. 2006 by, you know, Latinos and allies.
Well, I think one a lot of people think about is the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Yeah. I think that's one that people even outside of Chicago think about quite a lot.
Absolutely. That's a tentpole one right there. Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's another, you know, another theme of police scrutiny in that one, too, where you have 10,000 protesters and 23,000 law enforcement and National Guard. And permits denied, and, you know, all these things attached to that I think a lot of people, you know, kind of cried foul on that, hey, this is, we have the right to assemble and to protest this. And, And this seems a bit excessive to more than outnumber us.
Yeah. And they kind of, if you think about it, having been over, you know, what, 24 nominating conventions up to that point, not another one until 1996. Mm-hmm. I remember all the press about it in the Trib and other places. But what this is, you know, kind of Chicago had turned a corner. And, of course, we've seen some corners have been turned, others have not.
Sure, sure, definitely. And I think, too, on that, in that particular instance, I mean, was that... I think the way history tells it anyway is it seems like, because there was such a theme around the Democratic National Convention in particular of permits being denied. And I think there was a lot of, you know, oh, this is all daily. And I think there was another moment where we had this, the Chicago, you know, network, the, you know, the old boys club.
Sure,
at work
sure. Machines, there. Machine, absolutely. And of course, that moment, as we hear on radio, you think about how it looked on TV. Kind of chaotic at the convention hall. Mayor Daley not being able to kind of, you know, grasp the moment, the cultural mm-hmm. moment that was happening, right? People
right.
were talking about, as we talked about earlier, this young man recently, as your experience, talking about the Vietnam War
yeah.
and talking about what can we do to affect meaningful long-term
mm-hmm.
change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that time, Mayor Daley, the first, seeming like he didn't have control of the situation.
Right.
And right there on a national audience.
Right. And it, I mean, and it looked so terribly violent. I mean, there was so much, there was tear gas that was
absolutely.
So excessively used that it went all the way up to the Hilton. I mean, it was just, you know, such this cloud settled over the city. And I think there was a lot of scrutiny around that. But I think a lot of times people, it seems like people lose sight of the fact that it's not just people out, you know, being a pain in the ass, that it's
right.
right, that there's a question mark attached to it, that there's a want and a need. And I think that's what's an important thing about a protest, is that not only is it one's right to do that, but it's there has to be a goal in doing it. And I think when the goal is unclear, that's when the protest sort of loses steam and it becomes less effective. And sometimes I think even detrimental to the cause, when you
yeah.
see six people outside instead of hundreds that you need to affect change, or when you see a lot of people at cross purposes. I think we saw a little bit of that during NATO, right? There were so many people out. And so, I mean, I was sitting on the breaking news desk at the Tribune following all of that weekend on social media. Mm. And I was following probably 30 hashtags at one point.
Oh, wow.
And on TweetDeck, all these different things. And I was like, okay, Occupy Portland's here. Occupy Chicago's here. I'm trying to draw on a map where everybody is and what's going on. And everybody had such specific demands they wanted of the leaders that it was very hard to kind of get one unified message out. So that, you know, I think NATO is an interesting time to look at too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think of Arab Spring and all these
yeah.
other kind of important conversations, Black Lives Matter,
mm-hmm.
And kind of organizing these thoughts, and, you know, even organizing through space. I mean,
yeah.
the most recent protests on Michigan Avenue, and I remember that comment I think I saw in the Tribune, this woman said, you know, I just want to buy an iPad,
yeah,
right? But to disrupt commerce, if you think about it, in a capitalist system, is probably the most subversive
it's
thing you can do.
Pretty powerful.
Say,
yeah.
Don't get that. You're not getting that iPad today.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
Right. And I think the picture that kind of rang around the city was the picture of the young woman in front of the Timberland store crying because
mm-hmm.
she couldn't get in. And it was like, the point has been completely missed here.
Right, yeah.
You know, by this.
Dramatic image, absolutely.
We're talking with Max Grinnell. He is the urbanologist. You can read all about him at theurbanologist.com. We're talking about the history of protests in Chicago. We got to take a quick break and get you to news. When we come back, we will keep talking with Max and take your calls, 312-981-7200. Back in just a bit, 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. We're playing all the festive hits. That's a good pick there, Shane Rudin. All the festive hits tonight for Bump Music. And happy holidays to you all. So we are joined tonight by The Urbanologist. You can find out all about him at TheUrbanologist.com. His name is Max Grinnell. He is a frequent contributor to the station, and we always appreciate when he stops by because he has such excellent information for us because he knows all things about history of Chicago. And so what we're talking about tonight is the history of protests in Chicago, because I'm sure you've noticed there have been a few of them lately. One or two. And I think it's really important for us to always put things in historic perspective and think about the bigger picture. And why do the same themes keep coming up, as we were talking before the break? Some of the things that were of great concern to people during the Haymarket situation in 1886 are echoed right now with our police force. And so there, that to me points to some bigger systemic things that have not been addressed in over 100 years, really. So we're talking all about that. And right before the break, you mentioned Arab Spring and the role that social media played in that. And we're talking a little bit about NATO. And I think that I think it's worth talking a bit about social media because that has been such a fascinating addition to it. I think in most ways, 90% of the ways, it has really improved the activity of protesting, and people can organize in a different way and connect with people on other sides of the world. And it's also, I think, interesting to watch something unfold on social media. I mean, I was able, I felt like I had a really interesting seat to watch protests happening in South Carolina after the church massacre. Even though I wasn't there, I could see the things that were weighing on the hearts and minds of the people that were demonstrating, and I thought that was really valuable. But I also think sometimes it sort of encourages a bit of slacktivism, of the I'm just going to put a ribbon on my profile, or I'm just going to send one tweet about a topic, and then there I've spoken out.
Sure, here's the French flag background.
Yeah,
photo.
I've spoken out.
Right, that's my...
Which, like, you didn't really do anything.
God, slacktivism is a great portmanteau. I love it.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, fantastic.
I can't claim it, but it's a good one. Yeah,
it's wonderful. Yeah, I think you're so right. And it gives it this kind... And I think you can, and you know this so well, is kind of the sifting and winnowing of who are those reliable narrators. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't necessarily agree with their opinion on what's going on, one side of the protest, another, here's these people who are on the ground, and it's... It's exciting, you mm-hmm. know, and it has this dynamic quality, which, you know, always important to have a filter and a keen eye to, you know, who's doing the talking, who's sharing images. You think about the recent protests, the University of Missouri as mm-hmm. well. I'm thinking of that one as well, too, as someone who's involved in higher ed and mm-hmm. teaches college. That was kind of one I was particularly keen on.
Sure.
But yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is kind of, it gives it this kind of dynamic quality.
Yeah. You know, there is a section of protest in Chicago that is probably a lesser known one, but nonetheless interesting. And that was around musicians. And there was so much happening musically in Chicago. And this idea of you couldn't play recorded music on the radio, and musicians were unionizing, and at some point you had to have live musicians on the radio. I mean, that's even part of the fabric here on this station.
Sure.
You know, upstairs there's photographs of there was a piano player and a singer at the Drake that would come down here to perform music. And there's this wonderful picture of her kind of sitting on the piano and singing along. And you know, that's what an interesting evolution there now, where we can play any song we want as bump music and come back from break. And
right.
Where at one point that was such a big deal.
Yeah, and such a great Chicago connection too. James Petrillo, our own Petrillo Bandshell, mm-hmm. who was head of the union and, you know, enforced the recording ban during much of World War II, and this attempt to say we need to get more money for people doing live music. So a number of well-known jazz bands weren't recorded during that period, et cetera, who were doing innovative stuff, sounds we will never hear. But it's his kind of way as a pushback mm-hmm. Against this, you know, you can't stop this rising tide. I mean, obviously, he didn't stop the rising tide.
Sure. But I can't help but hear that and think about the way I'm hearing musicians start to talk about things like Spotify.
Right.
I can't help but think that there's a parallel there because, you know, you hear, so-and-so got, I don't know, 100,000, you know, listens on a song and got $400 for it.
Right.
Isn't that great? Well, no, that person has to make a living, and they can't make a living off of that.
And that's why we have everybody, you know, Bruce touring all the time, Adele, I mean, you name it.
Hello.
People seek that.
I knew you were going to do that, Shane.
I like
He's
it.
Always got Adele, like, on speed dial.
Boom. That was, like, perfect.
He's always got ready.
So that's, you know, you go out and people want to experience it in the same way, not so different, experience a protest, like be part mm-hmm. of something, mm-hmm. you know, Adele concert might be as important to the protest, right? Whoa, I love it.
That song
I'm gonna try some other
hurts
names.
People.
yeah, I mean, so there's, you're part of something. Here you are, and I don't know, maybe it's a function of getting older, but paying $12 for a beer and having people spill stuff on me. Oh, right. Anyways. But
see, that's why I like the City Winery. That's a good concert venue because you get a table.
Great place.
You get your own space. You don't have to elbow up through a crowd. You're like, I'm good.
Well said.
I've been in a mosh pit. I'm cool. I can just sit here at this table and get table service and eat something nice. It's all good. Yeah. I know. I first time I went there, I was like, this is a perfect concert venue for those of us who were in mosh pits in the 90s and are now too old to do so.
I was there.
I remember you there.
Oh, thank you.
Good times. We were both there.
Me and the Docs, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the Doc Martens were a key thing. So as we kind of think about, protests in Chicago, and there's so many avenues really to go down, I think we definitely have to talk about teachers too, because that's always been a big part of Chicago too, in the teachers union. We're going to take a little break. We're talking with Max Grinnell, the urbanologist. When we come back, we're taking your calls, 312-981-7200, all about protests in Chicago on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. We're hanging out with Max Grinnell. He's the urbanologist. We're talking about the history of protest in Chicago, because there's, gosh, I feel like we should have you on another time, because we could just talk about this for like 3 hours. There's so much to it, and so many layers, really. But I do not want you to escape the station before talking about, because you have lots of projects that I want to make sure we talk about. One of them is an important public library book situation you have going on. Let's talk about that.
I would love to talk about that. One Book, One Chicago is the program where every year Chicago Public Library picks a book. The city will read, reading groups, yeah. Conversations. This year it's The Third Coast by Thomas Dyjah.
He's been a guest on this show, a big fan of Dyjah.
Great guy. And it's a series, I'm doing a series of walks and talks. I did 15 in the fall, 17 coming up starting January 13th.
You're going to walk in January?
Those are the talks.
Okay. I'm not signing up for that.
And they're neat 45-50 minute talks with time for conversation. Mm-hmm. 20 great moments in Chicago in the 20th century.
Cool.
Chicago's public art, a retrospective, and the walks are everywhere from South Shore to Rogers Park. So if you jump on Chicago Public Library's website, you will see my smiling face and information about the walks and talks, and they are free to everyone. Last fall, we had 35 people at my Hyde Park walk, subject of my first book 15 years ago.
Nice.
And we just had a really great turnout and really great conversation about, like we're having tonight, about Chicago's history, past labor history, and all kinds of other things.
Okay, I want to throw an idea at you.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because you do these wonderful talks, and you do these walks, and all these things that you do. I have long thought that Chicago has such a rich and important women's history that long goes unnoticed. Can we organize that and make that a thing?
Let's do it. You and me. I accept your offer.
Okay, great.
I would love that.
Let's pick a day with good weather. Because all I will do is complain if it's cold.
Oh my God, you're just like my students, Amy. I love it. No, we'll do it. Like
I wasn't born here, so I'm not wired for the cold.
Post May, yeah, me neither. Seattle, just 50 shades of gray.
Sure.
Yeah,
I think that would be very cool. I mean,
we have
very important women have done important things in Chicago, and I think that would be a super cool thing.
Yeah,
lots of people would get on board with that.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to make that happen.
Done.
So you do all of these wonderful talks, and people should go to them. They should go to the Chicago Public Library website and read all about this. That's so exciting that you're doing that with the public library. Those are great programs. But also, there's other talks that you do. Particularly, I think there's one that is super interesting, and that's the travel writing. You do a couple, I think, really on that topic.
Yeah, one of my hats is, how I earn my keep is through travel writing. And I've done travel writing seminars, travel writing kind of talks around Chicago, and from Portland, Maine to Southern California. So it's been great. Again, take a look at my website, theurbanologist.com, or since you and I met via Twitter, at theurbanologist for musings, profound and otherwise.
And otherwise.
Sometimes it's otherwise.
You have a very useful Twitter feed.
Oh.
I would say.
Well,
some people are just out
you.
There spouting nonsense and being hateful, but you have a polite and very informative Twitter feed.
Oh, thank you. You can't see it. We're on radio, but I'm blushing. So that's very nice of you.
Good
thank
times.
You, Amy.
Well, gladly. All right. So we just have a few minutes left, really. But I, as we're talking and thinking about protest in Chicago, what do we think have been some of the big, I would say, the moments of great wins and the downfalls of some of our most known protests? Really, what were kind of turning points for some of the biggest that come to mind for you?
You know, we've mentioned it already, but I have to say that the 1968 convention protests obviously kind of left Chicago with a bad impression kind of nationally, internationally, of what some said was a little bit of a police state.
Mm-hmm.
but also kind of, you know, inspiration for future activists as well to think about how we can transform this place and what are those kind of struggles that we'll be able to continue with. I think, you know, other, and we talked a little bit about Haymarket already, was this is kind of what I'd say one of the darker moments in Chicago history, period.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you had these people who were immediately branded anarchists, you know, the equivalent of terrorists today, really.
Sure.
I don't think that's too far of a stretch, and kind of, you know, a miscarriage of justice on a number of fronts, even though some of them were later exonerated.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is probably one of the darker moments, too.
And what about the most effective strategies that activists have used over time in Chicago?
I think presenting kind of a list of specific demands is a kind of an effective tool. Now, this is not always effective, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. found out in 1966 after his, making his way through the Marquette Park neighborhood, mm-hmm. and then meeting with Mayor Daley in City Hall on the fifth floor, where he presented this list of, you know, XYZ, open housing, all these other things for African Americans. And Mayor Daley shook his head and then left.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is another example of not, despite his power and, you know, and kind of persuasiveness, this is another one of those kind of Chicago style moments.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely these kind of pivotal moments in this history.
Well, I think, I mean, as we think about wins that different groups got, I think, I mean, my brain goes to the difference between being right versus being effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of a key thing that I think it's important to consider if you're going to go to the effort of getting a permit and taking to the streets and getting people out there to rally around a cause. I mean, I think it's a subtle point, but I think it's a really important one, because you might want, you know, X, Y, and Z, but right now all you need to do is get to V and W, you know,
mm-hmm.
In order to get to X, Y, and Z, you're going to have to get to these two letters first, you know, and I think sometimes the focus is so getting to Z that we lose a kind of sight of the strategy to get there or the steps to get there, it seems like. And it seems like, I mean, I absolutely there are things to be angry about in the world right
absolutely.
Now. Absolutely. And absolutely, we have the right to go and express that anger in public and air our grievances. I think sometimes when emotions are so high, it's very hard to keep that in mind about being right versus effective.
Yeah. And you're right. What we've talked about this evening is that historical perspective, right? What are those long-term goals? And as you suggest, what are those steps to making incremental change?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you move from that place? You know, we've had an issue in Chicago for, you know, a number of decades about how do we reform the Chicago public school system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly, you know, blame to be cast and, you know, with a number of different groups.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard, you know, charters, you know, more charter schools, less charter schools. What's the role of teacher? What's the role of class size? How many, so on and
yeah.
so forth. And of course, the classic one in Illinois, you know, the battle with Springfield.
Yeah, right.
Among other things.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like all that happens education-wise is like it gets tamped down every couple of years. And to the point now that when there's a teacher strike, it's on a schedule. Oh,
mm-hmm.
it's time for the teacher strike again. Because there's just so many systemic issues that are not being fixed. They're kind of, it's like a lot of Band-Aids, but no one's fixing the broken bone.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it. I mean, it's kind of a patch-up triage job.
Yeah.
And how do you think, like the other things we've been talking about, what's that way to systemic change and lasting change, meaningful
right.
change?
Right, right. And I think that's really kind of what's needed, especially as we look at so many moments of public protest and public demonstration in Chicago have been centered around police and fixing issues with how police relate to the community and how the community relates to police. I mean, that in two ways there, I think there's a lot of that. What about for kind of a deeper dive, given your expertise, are there books on this topic, particularly around protest in Chicago and civil disobedience and that kind of thing? Are there kind of on the recommended reading list any books that come to mind?
Well, you know, one that certainly came up when President Obama was up for election the first time, Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals.
Yeah.
Definitely one that you know, and it's funny, this kind of not obscure to, and I used to be in the community development world, so community organizers knew this book, and of course it came up in the election, and everyone wanted to cast Saul Alinsky and Bill Ayers as, you know, kind of domestic radicals and, you know, complete subversive. But it's a great book, and it's a great rule, and I know that a lot of people use it on a regular basis. This is kind of a template. And, you know, I'll also send along, as I think about it, some other kind of more kind of deep dives on those. But that's one that I've always, and I've used in my classes with students, you know, these rules for radicals, you know, it's never been out of print. And it's one
for a reason.
For a reason. And it's, and he's a great organizer, back of the yards, Canaryville and other places that were successfully used in communities around the United States. And, yeah, top of my list, definitely.
And, you know, we are about out of time, but Back of the Yards is, I mean, we could talk an hour on just that community.
Next spring, one of my walks is in of the Yards.
What an interesting community. I mean, it played such a role in so many big parts of Chicago's history.
Absolutely.
And now we're seeing there's a lot of startup happening there. There's that, like, big indoor garden facility with, like, garden and agricultural startup happening there. There's a lot of interesting stuff happening.
Spectres of gentrification.
Yeah. I mean, it really is, really, which, again, could be a whole show. Okay, you got to come back another time because we have so much more to still talk about. All right, you can find all about Max Grinnell on theurbanologist.com. You can find out about his talks, his involvement with the public library this year with the One Book, One Chicago, all the great stuff that he's doing, full of great information. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
The time flies by, so we will have you back for sure. All right, my friends, we're going to take a break and get you to news, and then we'll be right back with Lisa Dietlin on 720 WGN.
When you find for some sad reason you're alone this Christmas season, and the joys of home grow dimmer, just like a
melancholy little holiday song on that one.
It's Andrea Bocelli.
No, I don't think it is.
Yeah, it is.
Who is that?
It's Andrea Bocelli.
No, who is it really?
It's a song from Bill Murray's Christmas special on Netflix, A Very Murray Christmas.
Sure. Who
is
singing?
Andrea Bocelli.
It's not, though.
I can't remember.
It's a boy band.
I'm going to assume that it's Andrea Bocelli.
Sure.
Who's at the Rosemont, coming up 2 weeks from now.
Listen to him go. He's on the take from his people. Anyway, hello. It's Amy Guth on 720 WGN. We're back with you till 2 o'clock when we turn things over to our friend David Plyer. Right now, we have our good friend Lisa Dietlin with us. You know her. She's the honcho lady at Lisa M. Dietlin and Associates. And from the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy, she knows all about giving and giving wisely and strategically. And we love to have her in to talk about those things because sometimes it is a bit overwhelming, particularly this time of year when every time we open the mailbox, we have all of these appeals to us. And, you know, they know what you're a sucker for because you get on one list and then you're on all the lists sort of like it.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, they put sad puppy and kitty eyes on every envelope, and I can't say no to them. And suddenly I'm like, well, I don't have Oprah money.
Okay.
I can't do this.
Okay.
But yet I have 50 little sets of eyes looking at me from these envelopes. What am I supposed to do?
You ever say, how did I get on this list? I don't even know this.
So many obscure ones.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I got one the other day that was an appeal for like ponies of a particular type of horse breed. That are particularly good as therapy horses, and you really need to support them early as ponies in order to. And I was like, well, that's reasonable, and they're so cute. What am I supposed to do here? I need Oprah money so I can support all the causes.
Yes, you do need Oprah money, but there can be a strategy behind all these appeals.
Tell us the way.
We open up our mailbox, and we get so many of them, especially at the end of the year. You know what most people don't realize, Amy, is that 80% of charities receive 50% of their funding in the last 2 months of the year. So if you're feeling overwhelmed, if listeners are feeling overwhelmed, it's true.
You are.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if you depended on 50% of your budget in the last 2 months of the year, you would be asking and asking and asking. So here's my recommendation. There's a couple of them. First of all, don't give because there's sad eyes on the outside.
It's hard not to.
It's hard not to. You know, put them in a pile and let them sit there for a minute. And then think about, what did you do last year? The first step is take an assessment of what you did last year. And if you're like me and you're getting ready for your taxes, you know, you might be pulling some receipts together. But, you know, what was important to you? Most of us give to a house of worship and our alma mater or our children's school. And then we may have about 3 other charities. That would be 5 you're giving to. And for most of us, that's a lot. Take stock of that. And then think about this past year. What happened that was really important to you? Maybe you had a sister diagnosed with breast cancer. Maybe a cousin adopted a child. Maybe a friend adopted a pet. That's really cute. And you want to support those organizations. So maybe something gets bumped off or something gets brought higher to the top. Then think about what's your budget. How much do you want to give? Do you want to give a little to a lot? Or do you want to give a lot to fewer? And then make your decisions. Look at those appeals and filter those in with yours, with your decision. And always save a little extra for those unexpected requests. You know, I have 6 nieces and nephews, and I'm always being hit up by their band
I'm
fund.
Running this race. I'm going to this field trip.
I'm doing this. And you know, my budget for each of them is, first of all, they have to ask, not their parents. And they get $30. And, you know, so sometimes we're on the phone. Okay, I've got cotton candy, you know, I've got
gift wrap.
Yeah,
I've
got candles. I'm like $30, you know,
decide $30. Where it goes.
So set the budget. Set the budget so that they, you know, and they know what's affordable.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
And then what about, here's the one, here's what drives me nuts. A lot of charitable organizations in their year-end appeal want to give you something.
Yeah.
To get your money.
Yes.
Those upset me, and those are the ones I set aside.
Right.
Because I don't want a tote bag. I want to give you $20 or whatever, however much, to feed those little puppies and kittens, and I don't want stuff in return. I don't want the tote bag, and I sure don't want a nickel glued to the top of the envelope or the address labels or any of that stuff.
Well, and,
it becomes like ethical.
Right, and that becomes a dilemma. You know, we had this discussion in graduate school when I was in graduate school, and I talked to my classes about it that I teach. Do you keep the labels or not? Do you keep the nickel? Do you keep the tote bag if you didn't ask for it? I mean, those labels, nobody else can use them if they're your pre-printed address. And do you use them if you don't give to that organization, or do you not? And, you know, it's 50-50, honestly, every class. Like, well, yeah, of course you'd use them. And half the class was like, well, no, you wouldn't use them. That's called transactional philanthropy. And I wish we would get beyond that, because exactly what you said, Amy, is where people want to be. They want to be in transformational. They want to make a difference. You know, we live in a post 9/11 world. And when planes flew into buildings and people died and they had dreams and hopes, all of a sudden people started realizing that it really didn't matter how many homes you owned or how big your bank account was or how many cars you had in the driveway. What was really important was, did you help somebody out in this life? Did you make a difference? And that's a transformation you want to happen. But so often we get caught in this, especially on the nonprofit side. Okay, if you give, you know, $5 a month, we're going to send you a coffee cup. And that's just not what people want.
Well, it's like the pledge drive model, right? It's like, if you give us $25, you get this DVD and all this stuff. And I mean, I like the opt out.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not giving because I want the stuff.
Right.
I'm giving because I want to support this thing.
Right. I was just laughing with a friend. We were talking about all the tote bags that you get when you go to conferences, or, you know, or that you give money and you get these tote bags. And I said, well, I guess it's a good thing I have all those tote bags, because now in Chicago with, you know, the plastic bags going away, like, okay, at least I have a bag that I can put my my groceries in. But oh my gosh, Amy's holding up 2 tote bags from different nonprofit organizations.
Yes.
We won't say which ones. My whole back of my car is filled with them.
Right.
My friend used to say, this is the truth. When I was doing aerobics, you know, step aerobics, and my friends would say, you always had a different t-shirt. You knew what cause you were supporting because you'd have these t-shirts. And that was in the 90s, you know, that you'd have a t-shirt that said the name of the organization. And I thought, oh gosh, you know, that's really true, that they would give you these t-shirts all the time, or now it's tote bags, or it's nickels tape. I wish nonprofits would stop that they would believe enough in their mission,
right,
and that people would respond and will respond, because that's what America's built on. That's what we were founded on. You know, I love Thanksgiving. You know that. We talked about it. Where we came here in this country, and, you know, there was this king in England, and we didn't have a state religion. And so if we wanted something, we had to do it ourselves. If we wanted a church, or if we wanted a library, or we wanted a hospital, a workhouse, an orphanage, we had to build it ourselves. We had to find the resources to do it. And time again, we do that. You know, it doesn't matter if...
Well, it's the George Bailey model, right?
Yes.
It's a Wonderful Life. At the end, his friends came through for him in his time of need.
Absolutely. And we always come through. as Americans, we always come through. You know, whether it's a superstorm Sandy hitting or Hurricane mm-hmm. Katrina, nobody says, well, I gave to Hurricane Katrina, so I'm not going to give my year end. No, those appeals come and we're still giving at the year end. And Superstorm Sandy, if you remember, it hit in the fall. Mm-hmm. We still gave that fall to our traditional charities that we want to support. I think it's really important for Americans to realize that, this is what we do. This is who we are as a people. And for nonprofits to realize they don't need to send us the tote bag or the coffee mug.
I wish they saw their value, really, and that they to me, it's almost, I want my charities to be confident and to know we got them. Mm-hmm. Those of us who support that cause, we have that cause, and we don't need to be bribed to support them. We're talking with Lisa Dietlin. She is our very good friend and our philanthropy expert on all of those things to help us make our dollars matter and make them stretch to help the most possible number of people and creatures and causes in the world. We have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we'll be taking your calls, 312-981-7200 on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Oh boy, he's busting out the Mariah Carey.
I love this song.
Should we sing?
No.
Oh,
no.
Come on.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Shane.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes,
come on.
You should.
Okay, Shane, if you
never
start singing.
Know.
Lisa's singing. I'm not singing. Come I'm turning my mic on.
Wish come true.
What's happening right now? Oh my God.
All I want for Christmas.
Good Lord.
Is
to fade out the singing. Oh my God.
You.
All right, then.
I don't want
As I said, it is 720 WGN.
I love Shane.
Who doesn't? Everybody loves Shane, and he is picking some fantastic and festive music this evening, including...
I got to put my Santa hat back on.
Including that little sing-along, which was unexpected, and he keeps trolling me with Adele. It's the new Rick Roll is what it is. He's trolling me with Adele. Lord have mercy. Anyway...
Maybe you could sing some of your
Adele.
Adele's
going to be on TV. Oh. I was like, what? Who? People talking? What? Anyway, we are talking with our good friend Lisa Dietlin all about transformational philanthropy, because she is an expert on all things philanthropic, and she loves to bring us excellent information about how to make our giving dollars help as much as possible and to give in a smart and effective way, because as I mentioned earlier, this time of year, our mailboxes are stuffed with appeals, and many of them are pulling at our heartstrings, mm-hmm. like mine, because everyone knows I'm a sucker for little creatures. And so they all have little sad eyes looking at me from the envelopes, and I'm like, I don't have Oprah money, but oh my gosh, I have to give to everybody. And right. I end up giving like $5 to a ton of different places, when perhaps it could be more effective to give bigger sums to just a couple.
And that's my recommendation. My recommendation is to really streamline your philanthropy. No more than five. If you think about if you have a house
five
of worship. Five
organizations.
Mm-hmm. If you have a house of worship and an alma mater or a children's school, and then three others. And to be a little bit more strategic. So maybe instead of giving, 100 charities $5, you give five charities $100. And you are starting to be a philanthropist mm-hmm. in a way that is meaningful than a $5, as we were talking, a transaction. But I also want to say to the listeners that it's okay to say no. It is okay to say no, that you can't, well, everything is worthwhile. There's 1.6 million nonprofit organizations out there, and all of them think they're doing amazing work, and the majority of them are. This is not a criticism of their work, but some of them just don't tug at your heartstrings. The way I look at philanthropy is in two areas. It's either it's organizations that are lifting people up, so you think arts and culture and education, or it's organizations that are getting rid of something. They're getting rid of disease. They're getting rid of poverty. They're getting rid of hunger. And most people gravitate to one or the other. I go for the lifting up. Mm-hmm. I love the arts and the culture and the education and empowering people to do better in their lives, lifting them up. But a lot of people want to, fight, malaria in the jungles, or they want to, fight poverty. And so to me, sometimes that just seems so huge that where does my $100 matter, you know, in that in that battle versus saying, oh gosh, $100, I could, you know, fund maybe a field trip or part of a field trip for a class of kids that want to go to the field museum or something.
Well, where is it? I know there's so many websites out there that do things like this, but which one do you, or which couple of them do you prefer? Because it is hard to know.
It is.
How, well, where does my $50 go? Is that going to, is that an overpaid CEO and only $10 of that is going to go feed someone who I want to feed? Or is all of that, or 90% of that going to go to the cause that I want it to go to?
There's that's a great question. There's three organizations that I recommend. My favorite is GuideStar, and it's guidestar.org, and it's free. And you simply, you know, register, you know, with your email address, and then you search for the organization. So you put in the organization name, and if there's multiple organizations of that name throughout the country, you put the city and the state in. And what comes up, Amy, is actually their 990, their tax form. And you can actually see how many dollars they raised, how much money they spent, what the top three people are paid, meaning the highest paid people. You can see who's on their board. And you can see how many dollars went to programs. I just did this recently for an organization that someone wanted me to meet with, and they were giving $0 to the program. And I said,
how's that even possible?
Well, because they were, you know, a startup and there was lots of money going different places. And I said, okay, here's some questions that I have that I think you need to ask this organization. This is what I told this person. So that's GuideStar is my favorite. Charity Navigator is really good. It's a quick and easy, and it's the star ranking, and they're getting better and better tools in their toolbox about, you know, reporting and evaluating that it's just not on one metric that they're measuring. And then the Better Business Bureau. Most people don't realize it has a charity arm called the Wise Giving Alliance, and they actually have over 20 standards that they rate primarily national charities on. And they provide a charity seal of approval from the Better Business Bureau. And you can look at that. So they also do a myriad of, you know, standards that they want nonprofit organizations to meet. What I tell folks that ask me, one of my famous stories is that, you know, I was working out at the gym and the woman in the locker next to me said, you know, when she found out what I did, she said, you know what, I don't give to a charity that spends more than 3% on overhead. They spend more than 3%. She said, I don't give to them. And I looked at her and I said, you're a fool, because they're burying it somewhere. No organization can exist with 3% overhead. It's just not possible. I said, if they're running effective programs, I said, could you live on 3% of your salary? Could you live, I mean, to pay your light bill and your mortgage and your rent, all that? Could you? And she said, no. I said, what they're doing is they're putting it under education or marketing or something else. I said, 15 cents on a dollar is okay. That 85 cents is going to the program and 15 cents to overhead. 25 cents is still okay in my book if it's a worthwhile cause. When it gets to 50 cents, I got to look at it and scratch my head. No. If it's a new organization and it's just coming online, well, perhaps there was a lot of overhead that needed to be funded in the beginning. But be a smart donor. Take a look and just don't look at one metric, one measurement. Sometimes there's an anomaly in a year. And you can look, and GuideStar has, you know, the 990s for the past couple of years, and it's their actual tax returns.
Yeah. I think, too, a point you make often is about getting involved in other ways to make your giving go further with beyond just your dollars, is to kind of be involved in that organization. And that, too, I think, gives you sort of an inside view of what happens to your dollars.
Absolutely. And start small. You know, if it's a new organization and you're not sure, you know, write a check for $25 and see if you get a thank you. You know, nonprofit donations are one of the last deductions on our tax forms that we can deduct. You know, in my lifetime, I've seen, you know, credit card interest go away, car loan interest go away, you know, away, all these. But charitable donations are still deductible on your tax return. And so the idea of, you should be getting a receipt, especially if it's over $250, the organization should automatically be sending you a receipt. But if you're a brand new donor to an organization and you send $25 in, watch and wait and see, how long does it take for you to get a thank you? How long does it take for you to get an acknowledgement? Because if you're a new donor and you're sending $25 and I don't know how you found out about us, I sure hope that my program is set up that I'm thanking you right away and saying, can you come in? Can you do a tour? Would you like to volunteer? Would you like
to hear about us?
Right. How'd you hear about us? Would you like to sign up for our newsletter? I would hope. And especially in today's day with the, you know, technology that we have available, it is very easy for nonprofit organizations to do that. I also recommend calling Does anyone call you back? Well, if they're not calling you back and you're saying, hey, I want to volunteer, hey, I want to donate, hey, I want to talk to somebody about this, how are they running their program?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they need to step up their game. And if they're not, I actually had a, when I worked at a university here, I had this gentleman call, and he actually called the assistant dean, and I trained them, and he called me, and I called the gentleman back, and he said, that was actually the first test to see if you would call me back. And he ended up leaving $500,000 to the organization.
Wow.
And here was his thought, because he and his wife were aligned with Northwestern University of Chicago, and they said, our $500,000 won't matter at those institutions because they get big gifts all the time. But at this school, it will matter.
Mm.
And he said, but the first test was, would you call me back? And I've had other people say, you know, they want to volunteer and they call. They might call 20 organizations at the time and nobody was calling them back. And I was like, well, then you don't want to be involved with those organizations. So pick up the phone, make a phone call. You know, one of my favorite sayings is being patiently persistent. You know, if you want to get involved with a nonprofit organization, be patiently persistent. And if that one's not working, the one that you had your heart set on, look down the road because there's a lot. There's 1.6 million.
That's
that
a
exists.
Lot of them.
Yep.
And some of them are going to align with you.
Yes.
All right. We're talking with Lisa Dietlin. She is the honcho boss lady at Lisa M. Dietlin and Associates and at the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. And she always brings such excellent information with her. We're going to get you to news here in a second. But when we come back, we are talking about things you can still do to help make the Christmas season very special for people in need.
Wife says to me, let's not drive the old coupe. Hitch the horse again to the one horse open sleigh. The horse was awful mad. If he could talk, he'd say, you'll be sorry you hitched me to a one horse open sleigh.
That's a good one. 720 WGN. Shane, who did you say was singing that song?
That is WGN's own Orion Samuels.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
You're pulling my
leg.
No,
I'm not. I'm not. It's it was a Norwegian band that started the song, that wrote and did the song, and then sometime early in, I think Orion did it when he was in his late 20s, early 30s, they had a contest of who could replicate the song the best, and Orion won. It was this one and another song called I Used to Go Nuts at Christmas.
Sure.
It's some kind of Norwegian thing. I'm sure Roger could speak out.
I thought he was
going to
say,
yeah,
Andre,
that's the song.
Roger,
the,
what, huh? Is he making this up on the fly? Just,
no,
is this like a snipe hunt? What are we doing?
That's Orion.
That's real?
Yeah. Play it again. Play a little bit again, and you'll recognize it.
Jingle bells, the jingle bells, the jingle all the way. My wife sure hates sleigh bells since she rode that one horse sleigh.
Well, I guess it is.
I thought he was going to say Andrea Bocelli.
Yeah, all night, everything's been Andrea Bocelli. That voice you're hearing is Lisa Dietlin. She's our good friend and expert on all things philanthropy. And so she always comes to us to help us give in ways that are meaningful and effective and strategic and that make the most so we can make the world a better place. And we're always happy when she comes to visit us. So we've been talking about year-end giving because I know your mailboxes are filled with envelopes like mine with different kinds of appeals. But before, you know, we're not even there yet. We still have a couple weeks left of the year. And Christmas week is upon us. And I think a lot of people every year aim to do very good things and want to give back and want to do big things. And then suddenly it's, oh, it's here. It's too
late.
And I think a lot of the opportunities that exist, like serving in a food pantry or soup kitchen or something, you have to book them way in advance now because a lot of people want to get involved in those days. But it's not really too late. There are still things people can do.
There are still things people can do. And you're right. Those activities, those volunteer activities are booked years, definitely a long time ahead. But one of the things I would say to folks and the listeners is that it's just not on Christmas Day we need to serve.
Right.
You know, think about picking a day in April, you know, saying to your family, you know, we're going to do the quarter Christmas celebration on April 25th. We're going to go and we're going to serve, or, you know, the half year, what have you. But think about serving at all times. But something you can do, you know, most of us think about Christmas and children and making sure, we want to make sure every child has a happy holiday and that there's something under the tree for them. And believe it or not, kids still write letters to Santa and they go to the post office. And if you go to the Harrison post office, the big post office, you can pull a letter. You can read all of them, pull a letter, and you can actually fulfill that child's dream. That child's wish. The post office has been doing this since the early 1900s and, you know, serving as Santa's helpers. And there's still time to do that. So when you're mailing your packages, maybe wander over and there's usually a postal worker there. And I love the U.S. Post Office. I know they get a lot of criticism, but, you know, I think this system we invented at the founding of our country that anybody can write a name and an address and a letter and put a stamp on it and send it and it gets there. Oh my goodness. I love our system. And the fact that they stepped up and said, we want to make sure that these children are, you know, having wishes fulfilled. And here's what's interesting. It's not the Xboxes or the Game Boys or the iPods or iPhones. What they're asking for is a coat or some boots or maybe something for their siblings. And, it can be tough. And again, like we were talking before the break about lifting people up or getting rid of something. I mean, this is about lifting people up, but it could be a tough letter to read. But you can actually help and you can make a difference in a child's life by doing that. There's still opportunity, though time is fast fading, for the layaway angels that we've talked about in the past, where you go in and you pay off someone's layaway. My mom just did this 2 days ago for our family. We forego exchanging gifts, and, you know, instead of doing the, you know, $20-$25 gift exchange and drawing names, we put all that money in a kitty. And somebody goes, and this year it was my mom, and she worked with the layaway clerk to say, can you find in here a package with children's toys? And it had children's toys and children's clothing in it. We paid it off. The clerk called the family. We don't know who they are, but they were so excited, and they got their layaway, and they're going to have a good Christmas. So
you don't even necessarily have to do anything formal through the store. You
no.
just kind of walk up to the layaway window and just
say,
do it.
Yeah, and they're usually, oh, my gosh, all right, let's see what we can
do. Let's do it.
My mom was like, I could organize this so much better. I go, Mom, we don't need another project.
We don't need an overhaul. We just need to help. Well, and that's an important thing to think about, too, as you're going to do something like that, to ask specifically, make sure there are children's toys and clothes, that there isn't just pick somebody at random, will you?
Absolutely. And, you know, different stores have different policies. So some stores say, you know, you have to have the stuff out before 2 weeks before the holidays. Otherwise, they restock the shelves. Some it's, you know, up to Christmas Eve. So absolutely, there's still that opportunity. You might have to hunt a little harder but, you know, pick up the phone, call. You know, when you're in the store shopping, ask. You know, another idea is sometimes we forget our elderly, senior mm-hmm. citizens, and a lot of people are shut in at this time of year. And, you know, particularly today, it's really, really cold. And, you know, you think about those folks that might not get those visitors on Christmas Day. Maybe when you're out shopping, pick up a couple extra packages and drop them off at a senior center or at a nursing home. Call ahead, I always say. We always also have our VA hospitals and we have our veterans. Again, this can be a tough time. We, you know, if you watch, and you know, certain stations, I'm thinking like Hallmark, everything always ends wonderfully and every family. Well, I remember going to Mass. I'm Catholic. And the priest said, you know, the bulletin, there was a typo. Instead of saying have a Merry Christmas, it said have a messy Christmas. And he said, and he talked about the first Christmas probably being pretty messy in the manger. And he said, most of us have messy Christmases. And I think that's not only physically, but emotionally, spiritually, and all of that. And you think about, if you can do something by purchasing a gift or offering to go talk to somebody. Maybe you can't serve in a soup kitchen, but maybe on the 23rd or 24th, you go and you sit with a shut-in or an elderly person or a veteran and talk to them, or a child in a hospital ward. You know, they have programs. You have to call ahead and find out what the hours are and what have you. But there's a way that you can give and that you can definitely make a difference. Then we have Macy's.
Indeed. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk about Macy's, because Macy's is doing an interesting campaign with their Believe campaign.
Their Believe.
That I want to talk all about, too. We're talking with Lisa Dietlin. She's the honcho lady of Lisa M. Dietlin and Associates and the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. And she always brings us such excellent information about how to be very good and responsible citizens and help out others in need, especially important this time of year, but really important all year long. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Oh, I just gone nuts at Christmas on that happy holiday. When I go in the red,
we gotta listen to this
one. Cause I squander all my pay. Oh, I just gone nuts at Christmas. Shopping sure drives me berserk. On the day before, I rush in the store like a permeable jerk.
I look at my 720 WGN. According to esteemed producer Shane Reardon, that is our own Orion Samuelson singing that hit.
It is. I have no motivation to lie about that. It was recorded Andre in Bocelli. 1960.
It sounds like a young Bigo.
It does. It was what year? 1960?
1960.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that
55 years ago.
It's fantastic to know that that exists.
When he was 22.
37.
37.
I don't know.
It is but a state of mind. Age is but a number. Well, those are some fine festive hits, and I'm grateful to you for digging them up there, Shane. Those are excellent. I had no idea that our own Orion Samuelson was a Christmas crooner. I love it. All right. We are talking with our good friend Lisa Dietlin. She is the founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy and the CEO, honcho boss lady over at Lisa M. Dietlin and Associates, and she brings her expertise of philanthropy to us to make sure that we're doing good things in a smart way and helping people in need. And that's especially important this time of year, but it's really important all year long. Let's not kid ourselves. But we were talking a little bit about layaway angels, which is very important. And you talked about that earlier this week on Steve Bertrand's Business Lunch Show. And also about the letters to Santa at the post office, which is so great that we can just go to the post office here in Chicago and get a letter from a child who really wants Santa to help them. There's another company that's doing something this time of year, and that's Macy's. They're doing something with Make-A-Wish. Tell us about that.
Right. Macy's started about a half a dozen years ago, the Believe campaign, based on the letter that, you know, Virginia wrote, you know, is there a Santa? You know, is Santa still there? And that's the premise. And if you go into Macy's and you write a letter, and they have a little Believe station, and you write a letter to Santa, for every letter that's mailed in the Macy's post office box at Macy's, they donate a dollar to Make-A-Wish, up to $1 million. $1 million donation for the Believe campaign. And it's fabulous. Successful every year. I was just at Macy's last week and I saw lots of kids and even, you know, teenagers. And I go, let's write a letter. Let's write a letter to Santa. And they're writing letters to Santa and dropping them in the Macy's Believe mailbox. And for every letter that's written, it's a dollar. And here's what I didn't realize until recently, is that every 38 minutes, a child's wish is fulfilled by Make-A-Wish.
That's
they have partnered
huge.
With Make-A-Wish, and that will be $1 million donation to Make-A-Wish Foundation, which, you know, fulfills for those we assume everyone knows, but it's about fulfilling the wishes of children that are usually terminally ill or have life-threatening, long-lasting illnesses. And it could be that they want to go to Disneyland or Disney World, or they want to meet Taylor Swift or at a concert or something.
Or an athlete or something.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they arrange it. Make-A-Wish arranges it for that child. But Macy's has partnered with them, and Macy's does an amazing job. I know we miss our hometown, Marshall Field. Mm-hmm. You know, I hear people still grumbling
people
a little bit.
People still call it that.
Yeah, they do that. And we do miss that hometown flavor, but Macy's has stepped up in a big way in the charitable world, especially at this time of year. And, you know, bringing it all together with that Believe campaign, and that we still should believe. You know, we should believe in miracles. We should believe in the magic. And, you know, unrealized expectations oftentimes become realized on the holidays, on Christmas morning.
Indeed. And as you point out, it's important to try to take that spirit with us all year long. because it's very easy to feel emotional about the holidays and really think hard about people who don't have as much as we do. But, you know, we've talked about hunger before, mm-hmm. and that's a very real thing for people year round.
365, 24/7. And right. somehow we only want to think about it at the holiday time. Mm-hmm. And, one of my pieces of advice is don't clean out your pantry with things you don't want to donate to the hungry, because if you're not eating it or you don't know what to do, no one knows what to do with anchovy paste, or no one knows what to
do. That package of Melba toast that came in like a gift
buy things that you would want to eat and that's what you want to donate. Or better yet, because the food banks have such buying power, make a financial donation. You know, that I often recommend that people think about making a charitable plan of action. You know, we talk about, we get this onslaught of requests at the year end, but how about we be proactive and say, I'm going to donate $100 a month. And I'm going to pick different nonprofits that I want to support, or I'm going to pick four that I want to support, and I'm going to give them each $25 a month, and start to make your charitable plan of action that will actually affect change. Kids are hungry in April. Mm-hmm. Rivers need to be cleaned up in September. Books need to be put on library shelves in July. Seniors need programs in October. It just doesn't happen the last 2 months of the year. It's fabulous that that's when it comes to our mind. It's like, you know, when breast cancer is October, or, you know, autism is April, and we have these months that are designated. So it's wonderful that we have this, you know, trigger point. But I think it would be absolutely outstanding if we all made a charitable plan of action and then included some volunteer time, too.
Can I throw one thing in there, guys? Oh. Hi. And you just ended on that, too, Lisa. It's some people maybe don't have the financial wherewithal to donate something at this time of the year, and some may be hurting a little bit themselves for food or whatever. But you can still give, as you just said, your time. Time is very valuable, and if people are lost in the vastness of donating here or there, like, you know, where do I turn to? How do I find out where in my area I could be of use? Go to your local church or synagogue, and they have lists of mm-hmm. places that need people to help, even if it's only sitting with someone for a few hours a day and talking to them.
Absolutely. You know, you bring up such a great point, because we don't think about volunteering at this time of year because we get the onslaught of appeals in our mailbox. But volunteering is so critical. And in my first book, I interviewed entrepreneurs around the country and Canada about why they give away money. And what was interesting is what the women entrepreneurs said. The women entrepreneurs said, you know, Lisa, philanthropy is more than money. It's a hug, it's a smile, it's holding the door open for somebody, it's carrying in someone's groceries, it's shoveling their walk, it's raking their leaves. So, you know, even if you're thinking, gosh, you know, one more thing on my list, I love the idea that Roger is sharing and Lisa, but I can't go to another organization. Be kind to those around you. You know, I was out walking this morning with a friend, and we stopped at Starbucks, and this mom was struggling to get in with a stroller, and it was cold this morning. And I said, just a second. Held open there, and this big smile came on her face. All I did was hold open the door. All I did was help a mom who had a baby in a stroller and was trying to get in a store, mm-hmm. and I held open the door. And she said, oh my gosh, thank you so much.
Made her life easier for the moment.
Absolutely. And so if listeners can't volunteer, I don't have time, I don't have a car, I can't get there, you know, the requirements, whatever it is, think about what you can do with your neighbors. My brother, you know, lives in northern Michigan, and he works, you know, he works in the city, but he always makes time to snow blow his neighbors out, mm-hmm. you know, because they're an elderly couple. And he always did that, you know, just checking on them. Their children didn't live in that town. Mm-hmm. And so he took it upon himself to look out for those neighbors. It's simple things that you can do to make people's lives better. I was at the movies this week, and I had this fun necklace on, and it was with little lights, and it had been a gift to me. And the woman behind the counter really admired it, and she said, oh my gosh, I just love that. And I go, would you like to have it? And I took it off, and I gave it to her. And I thought, you know what? I wore it once. Let her wear it and enjoy it. I mean, it's those little things at this time of year.
It's a mindset.
Yeah.
More than a checkbook or necessarily a whole day of volunteerism.
Right, right. And one of the things you could do if you're thinking about if you have a mom like my mom who says, you know, can we spend more time together, or, you know, I don't get to see you enough, think about maybe your holiday present, especially if your money, as Roger suggested, is stretched a little bit thin. Think about saying, Mom, we're going to spend a day together in March and volunteer. And I found this organization, and you could wrap it in a card, you know, that, Mom, on this day, we're going to spend the entire day together, and this is what we're going to do. We're going to help this organization out. So there's still time this week to find those volunteer opportunities and maybe make it a mother-daughter or mother-son or father-mother or whatever, you know, a combination you want to put together and volunteer as a family.
That's an excellent idea, because then you get to the experiential gift. I think a lot of people are talking about that this year, because I think we've all realized we have enough stuff in our lives. Don't
Absolutely.
Give people more stuff. Give them experiences.
And we want to spend time together.
Right.
You know, my friend Marcy out in Tucson, what she actually does is she brings a chef into her home and invites her very best friends. She picks a day to come in and actually cook. And we make this meal together. So we learn how to make a meal. And we have this experience of hanging out with other fabulous women. Mm-hmm. And this is her gift, because she's like, you guys don't need anything.
Right.
You know, you really don't need anything. And it's such a wonderful experience.
That's a great gift. But I love the idea of having a charitable aspect to
Absolutely.
It too. And I think, too, sometimes we get really wrapped up in things having to go through an organization. Like, we need permission to be giving and to, you know, we have to show up at a charity in order to be giving. You know, one time I used to always do Thanksgiving at this particular soup kitchen, because that's my family spread out all over the place. We didn't
right.
even try to get together for holidays. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to go. And
right.
it's just me. I'm going to go do this. And it became this thing year after year. The same people were showing up every Thanksgiving. And it was the Thanksgiving Club. And
right.
we had so much fun doing that. It was great. Eventually, they said, you know what? We're getting overloaded with people coming in this time of year. You core people, will you go do it another day? Another month.
And did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're like, can you scoot this to February when we need you? Because we're stocked up right now, like from Halloween to New Year's. We're good.
Everybody
we're good.
Wants to do it.
And so we were talking about how that was such an important thing for us even to do, mm-hmm. that not just for the giving part, but we felt like, you know, it was a special part for us. And so I said, you know what? We don't need an organization. We don't need a place. We can make sandwiches and hand them out. We can do, you know, we don't. And then that became a thing. We've all kind of gone our separate ways now, but every once in a while, it's okay to just pick a day and, you know, hand out bottles of water on a hot day, or make a couple of sandwiches, or, you know, I usually keep a couple of granola bars in my purse. And if I see
right.
someone that needs money for food, I'll usually offer them
right.
one.
I was on WGN on Thanksgiving Day. I went to the parade with my mom, and, you know, parades too, people need lots of volunteers. So there's another activity you can do whenever there's a parade in town. But we went to the parade, and a friend was handling her while I was in doing the interview. And when I went back, she'd bought me a sandwich. But we were going to the Chris Kindle Market, and she's like, well, don't you want this McDonald's sandwich? And I was like, well, if we're going to the Chris Kindle Market. And this man came up to me, and he said, you know, do you have any money? I go, no, I don't. But here, would you like this sandwich? And he said, oh, my God, I would love that sandwich, just like you with granola bar. Sometimes we have things at our disposal that we don't even know. And it could be as simple as a smile. You know, the short version of the story is, you know, kayaking on the Chicago River, and this young man was telling me when he learned about what I did, about what his roommate does. And he said, every day Billy smiles at people and says hi to people all day long, because Billy read somewhere that the number one reason that people contemplating suicide don't commit suicide is that somebody acknowledged them, someone said hello, someone waved to him. So Billy all day long waves at people and says hello and acknowledges them. And at the end of the day, when he puts his head on the pillow, he's pretty sure he saved a life. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty powerful thing that you can do. And you don't have to be part of a volunteer organization.
You don't have to have any money.
You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to do anything. We just can be a kinder, gentler, friendlier, loving community.
Perfect. Well said. Lisa Dietlin, thank you for being with us. You always lift us up and bring us such wonderful information.
Oh, happy to be here. And, you know, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, all those good things.
To you too.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. We are playing all the festive hits this evening, thanks to esteemed producer Shane Reardon. Thanks for picking all those fine, fine festive songs, Shane. especially the Orion Samuelson songs that
Hello.
Were earlier. No, more Adele. No, not the Adele. I don't thank you for playing all the Adele. You're Rickrolling me with Adele. Ah, my friends. We now have our good friend Kevin Alvis in studio with us, comedian and actor extraordinaire here in Chicago. And I'm sure that at some point in your cultural exploration of this fine city that you have encountered something he's worked on. We have encountered many of his projects over the years on this station, including the Klingon Christmas story.
Yes, that's where we first met.
That's how I first encountered you, because you were you looked a little different.
No, very different.
Because you were playing Scrooge. Mm-hmm. And so in the Klingon getup and speaking Klingon, you did not look like yourself. But nonetheless, that is a fine show.
Oh, it was so much fun. It was one of the most unique thing I've ever done. It was incredible.
And if you Google the words Amy Guth Klingon, you will see a picture of the evening I was given a cameo in one line.
The best.
To just walk on. And in Klingon, I said, "When challenged, you fight." And I had my robe and my weapon and crazy long hair and a Klingon head. And it was fantastic. It was a fine night.
And you nailed it, too. You nailed it.
I had been practicing quite a bit because you know what? I went to it a few weeks before that to see the show.
Okay.
And so the whole thing is in Klingon with subtitles, English subtitles on top like an opera. And I go and I see it, and there are people sitting in front of me that were so devoted to the Klingon language. They showed up in costume.
Oh, yeah.
And they were, one of them said something like leaned over and said something like, I think he sort of said a little bit Romulan pronunciation of that.
Oh, yeah,
he was
like
really nerded out on an accent on a word.
Oh, yeah. We had... It was great. That show was great because it was always kind of like a mini Comic-Con. You never know what was going to happen. And we did have actual Klingon speakers come who speak it fluently. There's not many around because it's so hard. But you can speak it fluently. A lot of people do. And when they would come, I mean, they enjoyed the shows. But
they were critical.
They're like, oh, you should have done a instead of a and then it's like, oh, okay, sorry. But no, it was such a great experience. I had so much fun with that. You know, we met through that. I was in the Wall Street Journal because of that. You know, it was so many little things popped up.
Yeah.
The first year we did it, right after we closed, Jimmy Fallon and Conan O'Brien mentioned the show in their opening monologues.
Life Achievement Jokerman. Unlocked.
It locked, man. It was great. It was just, and I got lucky enough to do that. I was doing it 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like if you go through the trouble of learning an entire play in Klingon, you want to stick with it a couple of years more than just one run of it.
What was great about that is with the first year, since it was new to the city, because it's the company's Commedia Beauregard and Christopher Kidder, he was the one, he and a couple of people had written that script in Minnesota, and they'd done it for a couple of years there. So when he came to Chicago, everyone was new to the project except for him. So we had, I think the cast was 13, and that first year everybody loved it so much that we had, I think, 10 out of the 13 return just because of scheduling and stuff for the other stuff, other folks. But it was nice because the first year we were all so terrified about the language that's what we were all so focused on. And everybody was so excited to come back to actually start blending out the characters and working on that, the acting side of it.
Sure.
Which was made us so happy because, yeah, you're so worried about that language because it's hard. It's really just a bunch of sounds and noises that you make, you know, like most any language technically is, but it's so alien. You know,
right.
it becomes
such a guttural language that has just so much physical stuff attached to it. I mean, there's so much like movement and hand gesture with Klingon in particular which
we found we had to because when you put on the latex ridges on your forehead, you can't move your face.
Oh yeah,
because if you move your face, then the glue comes off and your head comes off in the middle of the show, and sweat's poured in your eyes and things like that.
So weird. It's critical.
A lot of head and hand and like lower face acting.
Yeah, lots of like hands in the air.
Oh
and
yeah,
fists
yeah, yeah,
and, yeah.
I think somebody,
weapons.
I think a reviewer called it a very Kabuki style. I think in one of the reviews, which we were first like, it's not. Okay, I can see that.
Yeah. Okay, fair. Right. Well, so from there, you went on and you've done many, many projects. But a couple in particular are kind of regular ones that you do. One is called I Saw You.
Yes.
Via Bruised Orange Theater.
Yes.
Then that happens at the Town Hall Pub. That's every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday at 8 o'clock. It is honestly my
most damn funny
favorite thing I've ever done. It's for those of you who don't know, it's three actors just performing personal ads, and the personal ads are all from the Chicagoland area, so it's Chicago and the suburbs. They're all real. we don't change a thing. We don't write anything. It's really just
perform them.
Right. Our director, Mark Spence, he gets every week, he sits down, he goes through Craigslist and OkCupid and the Chicago Reader, especially now that they brought their personal ads back because they got rid of them, which mm-hmm. the show was simply just based on the Reader pieces to start with because that was the only game in town. And then all the websites, Craigslist and OkCupid came out, so we started pulling from them. But he goes through all those and he just finds these very funny, ridiculous personal ads that people are just really putting themselves out there, but just some of the stories they tell and the things about themselves and stuff, it's so funny and ridiculous. And he pulls those, puts them in a book for us, and we have a cast of 12 actors that rotate throughout depending on their availability. So he puts together the schedule, and then each week he puts together the pieces and the books for the actors. We show up an hour before the show. We each get 20 minutes to look at our new pieces. And off you go. And then then at 8 o'clock, we just start going. And it's, as an actor, it's great because you are working with two other people, but once you get to the microphone, it's just you. So you can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And if the piece lands, it's great. You got that energy to push you through to the next one. And if for some reason it doesn't go over that well, it's okay because I've got 15 more chances right behind it to give it a shot. Mm-hmm. So it has really been just one of my, outside of being an actual theatrical show, it's my favorite project I've worked on. It's my friend Jen Santanello is in the show. She told me when we first met, my wife and I moved here, she was like, I'm in this show. I think you'd really like it. Come check it out. And I was like, it's my night off. I don't want to go sit in a theater. She's like, no, it's at a bar. It's fine. And I was like, oh, I could go for a beer. And I went and fell in love with it. And I started being I turned into an I Saw You groupie because I don't live far from the bar where they do it down the town hall. So I would start going every time Jen was up. And then I just started going on my own, and I would, there were Wednesday nights where I look at my wife, I'm like, you want to go see I Saw You? She's like, yeah, I got a long day tomorrow. I'm like, is it okay if I go?
Are you cool?
She's like, go on down there. So I'd turn into a little weird groupie. I just loved it.
And finally,
they were
like, let's just give this guy a part.
Yeah, we don't have auditions that often, but they had one up, popped up not too long after I started going, and I was like, I want in. And I went and auditioned, and luckily, actually my wife went too, and we both got cast, so.
That works out, because if only one of you did, that might create some tension in the home.
What did you do to get in? Did you slip my 20? No, I didn't. It's fine. But we both just love the show so much. It's just a fun night. It's only $5 to get in. I mean, and you get an hour long's worth of comedy, and it's different every week. It's the same format, but you got different. We do brand new pieces every week. We have three different rotations of actors every week. And so, you might say, I saw that once, but you didn't see it the next time or the next time or the next time. Because, it's the same format, but the show's always so different.
And fresh personal ads.
And the things that people write and put out there, just amazing. I thought I'd heard it all before I started doing that show.
Sure.
And then some new things entered my world. And I was like, I can't unhear that now, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's what's so interesting about personal ads, right? People will really bear their soul in mm-hmm. them and really, really say some very personal things.
Absolutely.
You're like, has that worked?
You have that distance of the internet. It's like, there's people who call customer service and they're really mean to the customer mm-hmm. service person because they're on the phone. But when they get alive, they talk to them face to face, that's a different story, So people, when they put up their ads, they're like, it's just the internet. I can put up whatever I want. And some of the things are really well written, really smart, but it just happens to be really funny. And some of it's just, I couldn't tell you how many pieces I've seen that were just all capital letters, no punctuation, two pages long. And I'm like, what is this person thinking?
And now, are they all necessarily misconnections, or are they just kind of, here's what I'm looking for, like a personal ad?
Well, we run the gamut of the sections of types of personal ads you have. So we'll always start off the show with the misconnections, which is the, I saw you on the bus. I thought you were fantastic. I just couldn't go talk to you. Or, I saw you across, the street, so forth and so on. And then we move on to the seeking section, which is the straightforward, hey, I'm into these things, mm-hmm. I'm looking for somebody who's into these things and that stuff, the descriptions that people have of themselves or, the way they want to describe themselves. It gets crazy. And then we always finish up the show with the X matches, and that's the dirty, dirty stuff.
Sure.
Where people are like, I don't want to date. I just want to go do things.
I just want to meet up for the following activities.
Right, right. And we've actually had pieces where it's just like they will just – really just here's what I'm looking for. Number one, number two, number three, and you're like, oh my, it's
that's really straightforward.
Worse and worse every time. What's number 10 gonna be? So it's just so much fun, and it's great because it is in a bar setting, so it's very relaxed. It's not like you have to go sit at a theater and watch a show,
right?
You
know, it's not stuffy,
right? Because I mean, unfortunately, that turns a lot of people off sometimes. Mm-hmm. Is the fact that they feel like they have to go sit in this theater and it's crowded people, and I got to put on a tie. It's like, no, most theater you can still put jeans and a shirt on, you're fine. But here, it's just you go in. It's at a Wednesday night. You've had a rough Tuesday and a rough Monday because nobody likes those, and so you can go and kind of cut your week in half with just an hour of comedy. Have some beers and some laughs, and you know, a couple drinks, and hang out for a little bit afterwards.
It's a great audience you have around that. You know, the one I saw, the audience was, I mean, roll. I mean, it was so very funny, but it was just the audience was just in stitches, and that lifts the energy of the whole room up. You know, it's like this after work activity of like, oh, it's the middle of the week. Suddenly, I mean, people were so engaged and so lively because it is just so damn funny.
Oh yeah, people just get a kick out of it. And what's great about the show is we have so many people that come in once, and then you'll literally see them every Wednesday for the next two
like
months.
You.
And they bring, it's just like me with the group. They become the groupies and they start bringing more people. Mm-hmm. And if you work the door, you're always asking, so how'd you hear about the show? And it's like, oh, my friend brought me. And you turn to the friend, the friend's like, I come here all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell everybody they need to come. And then they bring 5-6 people. And those people bring 5 or 6 people, you know. And it's, you know, groups after work come, just friends or just general groups. It's actually an incredible date show. I always said it's perfect for your third date because of the subject matter, especially towards the end of the show. So you don't want to start off out the gate with some really dirty jokes, but it kind of gives you, you know, if I have a very twisted sense of humor. So it kind of gives you an idea of, you know, where if you're on a date with this person, it kind of gives you an idea where they stand on like their humor and their comedy and things like that, and kind of gives you a little insight into something you may not know already about.
Right.
So
see where they laugh uncomfortably.
Yeah, I've got a couple of friends of mine. They you know, when they're, you know, looking for something to do on a date, they'll bring them and I saw you.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's just a fun night, it's real laid back and it's inexpensive, and it's in the neighborhood down there in Boys Town. It's plenty of restaurants and food. You can go out to dinner first, then come see a show. You know, have a few drinks, and you're home by 10:30, and you're ready to go to work on Thursday.
Boom,
you
done.
It's great. It's great. Breaks up the week really nice. I love it. It is my most favorite thing I've ever done. Klingon was an incredible experience as far as like theater goes, but man, I could just do I Saw You all the time.
Well, and what's great about it is that it, as you said, you can go once and go the second time, and it's a completely different show because it's always fresh ads and just fresh content and so funny, and the choices that you make for the characters as you're performing them. I love it even more knowing that you only have about an hour to prepare.
Oh yeah, so many people think that we rehearse things, and in fact,
because
actually,
it seems that way.
And the show's been running for 9 years now. And when they did first start, it was actually it started like a lot of people say, you know, you tell them about the show, they're like, oh, me and my husband or me and my wife or whatever, we sit around and drink coffee on Sunday mornings and we read those to each other and we just laugh and laugh and laugh. It's like, well, we do that for you.
Yeah.
We perform those out. But that's how it actually started. Mark Spence, the director, Clint Sheffer and Anne Sonneville, who are all company members, back when Bruised Orange actually produced theater shows, they were transporting sets from one place to the space. They were in the van, and one of Clint just started reading them, doing voices, and they were like, "There's a show in here.
We could do this." This
9 years
thing.
Later, we got I Saw You still running. So
and what a testament to the show that people are you know, your best marketing vehicle is the people that go to it and keep going and
absolutely
keep going
word of mouth.
All right, my friends, we're talking with Kevin Alvis, local comedian, actor extraordinaire, on talking about all of his many, many projects, and there are so many more still to discuss. So please stick around. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us this fine evening. With you till 2 o'clock when we turn things over to our good friend Dave Plyer. My friends, we are hanging out with our very good friend, Kevin Alvis. He is an actor and comedian, and he does lots of things all around town. And I'm sure you have seen one of them or encountered one of them or thought about encountering.
I hope so.
We were just talking about his weekly show called I Saw You. It's at the Town Hall.
Yeah, it's out at the Town Hall pub.
Through Bruised Orange Theater Company.
Right.
There we go.
Yeah.
Those are the words I want. but that is not the only thing you do. You also do this other show that is kind of like live lit and comedy and acting and all kinds of stuff. Tell us about that show too.
We're a group called Cassandra. I think we're Chicago's only live lit sketch comedy show. So it's we have a group of, I think we were up to close to 10 now, I think. Again, it's one of those things where, you know, who's available this month? Can we do the show, sure. To do the show?
That's a good system because that way people don't get burned out.
It's great. And, you know, we all understand that we're all working actors and writers and improvists and things. And we have other projects working on. Yeah, mm-hmm. We got to, you know, sometimes you got to take some time off. But that's a great show. We're at the Hopleaf every last Tuesday of the month in the upstairs space. It's a free show. And basically what we do is we get together each month and we write, we'll call them radio style sketches. So we have a meeting, we come with our pitches and our sketches, we pick the ones we like, and we'll have a rehearsal meeting the next time, and then we get up and we perform them, and that we are moving forward with recording those and then podcasting those later. So it's, we're calling it New Timey Radio Show. So, like you know, we like to go with the radio show format, but it's, you know, it's definitely, we do some very adult themed sketches, mm-hmm. and, you know,
So if someone goes to that show, what can they expect as an audience member?
You know, it's my first description is it sounds very boring. You're going to see us reading off music stands, but it's still a very active show. It's the great part about it is because we have we always start off. We have a music our Jamie Brew, who is one of our musicians, who is a guitar player, but he plays comical songs, and he's hilarious. We'll always have some music, and we have our own written commercials in for fake products and things like that, and a lot of just fantastic sketches about either what's going on in the city or just some ridiculous stuff there. Sometimes it gets really insanely funny, gross, you know.
Sometimes the best kind of funny,
right? It's a wonderful what we use it to kind of really just let ourselves go and do mm-hmm. whatever we want, and kind of, you know, we find through each show, we find what boundaries we can push, where we can push them, how we can push them, so we can adjust those so we can still say what we want to say, push those boundaries, but still keep it entertaining for people mm-hmm. and have them come. Mm-hmm. And that's a free show. It's really relaxed. You come in, Hopleaf, incredible beer selection. So come in, have a few drinks, and grab a bite to eat downstairs beforehand, and then come up and just watch the show.
And that performance space is cool.
Yeah, it's a great little small thing. We've got a bar in the back, and so you can just relax. And the thing I like about that one is, since it is a radio style, you can sit in the back and not be able to see anything, even though the room's not small. Just close your eyes and listen, and it's fantastic. And we just have a crazy rotating cast of, you know, just really strong performers and strong writers too, because we do write everything. We're trying to keep everything just at our base, and that was started, we're just going over a little over a year now. A guy named Josh Segorin and Dan Krall started the show for Sketchfest years ago. And they just said, hey, let's just start doing this every month. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, they've been really looking for an outlet for writing and things like that. So decided to do the show. Hopleaf agreed to have us, and we've been doing it for a year, and we're actually got to be... We'll be performing in Sketchfest coming up in January as well, Chicago Sketchfest.
Excellent. I think so many great projects happen just as a one-off, and then, hey, that worked really well. Let's keep doing it.
Absolutely.
So many good projects start
I had a teacher in college when my theater, when I was getting my degree, he always said, hey, you know, when you get older, when you get out in the world, you're not going to cast a whole bunch all the time because the market's flooded. Let's just go ahead and say that. So he always said, if you can't find the work, you make the work.
Yeah.
And that way you get your face out there and you're moving forward on your career. So many people at this point in our lives is, you know, we're just like, well, let's just do some stuff.
Because it's fun.
Right. It's fun. And, you know, there's so many outlets out there now too, whether it's, you know, find a space at a bar and do a show, or, you know, podcasting at home, you can get the equipment, you know, base equipment fairly inexpensive. Mm-hmm. You can just start doing whatever you want, you know, get a camera, go out and make a YouTube video.
Yeah, the barrier of entry is like rather low for creativity right now, and it's exciting.
It really is.
I think the same applies, and I think this is everywhere, but Chicago has a special something around this, and that is the way that bars and entertainment come together in the city.
Oh, absolutely.
It's very special because I think that applies even to the literary community. There are so many live literary events every single week, every night of the week in mm-hmm. the city. And I love that most bars in this town have a theatrical event at least once a month.
Absolutely.
And have some kind of literary event at least once a month. Some of them have both of those weekly.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a very cool thing that I think is very special to Chicago, because it's not about a high ticket price point. It's not about sitting in an uncomfortable theater. It's not about being a patron of the arts kind of person. Mm-hmm. It's for everybody, and it becomes very accessible that way.
Yeah, very accessible. There's a show called Write Club at the Hideout every month. Ian Belknap does it. It's a
That's
writing.
That's a great series.
Oh, live
yeah.
lit. It's a live lit competition show, and it's at a bar, and it's chill, and people come, and they have a great time. They pack the house mm-hmm. every month because people just want to hear some good entertaining writing and performing and have some drinks and just relax and let it go
Definitely.
And not have to be stuffy somewhere.
Right, and I think the lines between where between theater and writing have gotten blurred as a result in a really cool way.
Oh, yeah.
In a very exciting way where kind of live lit becomes theater and theater becomes literary and storytelling. And, you know, I think of like Second Story is a good example of where those lines blurred and never tried to pull away from each other again.
Yeah,
you know, that's such a great storytelling group that does such interesting work. And, you know, for those of you who are not familiar, if you've never been to one, you're in a bar and the person sitting at the bar next to you might suddenly hop up and stand on that bar and be hit with a spotlight and tell an incredible story with sound effects and everything. And it's really exciting. And as the night goes, the stories usually get a little bluer and it's all very fun. So, my friends, we're talking with Kevin Alvis, actor and comedian extraordinaire, and we will be right back in just a bit. We're going to take a break and get you to news and all that, and then keep on talking with him about all the wonderful things happening right here in our own city, here on 720 WGN. Girls will make you look up, working on your way. You 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us. Hey, you know what? I told you a fib earlier. I said that we were going to turn things over to Dave Plyer at 2. Kel Supree, no, not quite. Jim Toronto is in for Dave Plyer tonight, so we are going to turn things over to him at 2 o'clock. So that's exciting news for us all. So we are talking with our friend Kevin Alvis, who is a writer and an actor and a comedian and does all these wonderful creative projects here in Chicago. And we love all the things that he does, and we always like to hear about them. And you have yet another project cooking because you like me, like to wear 15 hats at a time.
Got to stay busy.
Exactly. We can't just sit around. So talk to me about Factory Theater.
Oh, the Factory Theater, my other love. My wife and I just recently became company members with that company, which is we were so excited about. They've been around, I think, right around 23 seasons they've run. It's been a long, long time. And it was a company that when we first moved here and started meeting people through some mutual friends, everyone said, oh, you got to go work with the Factory. You got to go work at the Factory. They're such a great company. We finally saw some shows of theirs and immediately was right after was like, oh, we've got to work with this company. They're a fantastic group that's an all-in-house kind of thing. They have a large company. I think we're around 20 something or so strong, and everything's produced in-house. All of our shows are written by company members. They're, you know, for the most part directed by, you know, we'll get some outside directors every once in a while, but produced, everything's in-house, which is fantastic. It's all original works. We're completely unapologetic about what we do. It's another place where theatrically you can push yourself. Primarily known for ridiculous over-the-top comedies, but you know, that all depends on what the company feels like writing. You know, sometimes I think it was 2-3 years ago, they did a show called Incident Run 1217, which was not a ridiculous comedy. It was a very strange, creepy, awesome show that Manny Tamayo wrote that took place on an L train that was trapped underground, Red Line, and two guys basically held some people hostage and tormented them for however long the show was. And it was incredible and strange and creepy and just really well done, but it was totally outside the box of what they normally do. Mm-hmm. Actually, that won a Jeff Award that year. Tied for Best New Work. So, but they're a great, great company. Wonderful shows. Last show I did with them was Hotel Aphrodite. That was last year. It was a fun show that was about it was a farce that took place at a sex hotel run by a sex therapist. The hotel was there to help people strengthen their relationships.
Sure.
But then it was somehow turned into the hands of her very religious cousin who didn't know what it was. Then the farce rolled in and everybody, of course, she showed up unexpected, blah, blah, blah. But it turned out to be a fantastic show. So many wonderful, wonderful reviews of that show. People loved it. But that company is so awesome. And we are so lucky now that we used to be, for all that time, out the prop theater on Elston, but we recently have been lucky enough to acquire our own space, which is in the process of being built right now.
That is very exciting. Oh, being built even.
Yeah, it's up on Howard at 1623 Howard, right off the Red Line, mm-hmm. up in Rogers Park.
So people now have no excuse. If it's right off the train.
Right off the train.
You're out of excuses.
Yeah, you're out of excuses. I mean, and there's some great restaurants and everything around there. And so we rented out two storefronts fronts, and then we're building our space in there. It's going to seat about 80. And it's we're hoping to revitalize the theater community there in Rogers Park and get some more, you know, stuff going on up there. It's really nice area. And so we're really, really excited about that. We finally got some permits going on, so with the works cruising along, so we can hopefully start our brand new season in our brand new house very soon. We've got 3 great shows already on deck. One of them being was we were actually supposed to do this show already this past fall, but because of city permits and things getting pushed, we unfortunately had to postpone it. But one of the shows that we have lined up coming as soon as possible is Zombie Broads. It's written by Sarah Savini and Corbett Pasco. It's a great story of a group that is a book club, quote unquote book club, but basically they just prepare for the zombie apocalypse. But then one night the zombie apocalypse, of course, happens. And then you've got this group
they're ready
and they've been practicing their fighting and they have all these homemade weapons and now they get to put them into use, and it's such a fun show. Unfortunately, we did actually start rehearsals for that one, but unfortunately because of permit problems and things like that, we did have to push that one back. So we've already kind of got an idea about what the show's about, and it's going to be just the best, and I'm so excited.
So, what is the timeline now on getting the theater open and all of those things?
You know, right now, we're not going to officially announce anything until we have like the right paperwork in hand to say, okay, right. Now we're a month out from being able to open the doors. Yeah. So now we'll start talking about dates and things like that. But I'm personally keeping my fingers crossed that it sounds like it's moving along well enough that we should hopefully have some stuff coming up pretty soon.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to be
soon.
Definitely not going to be a situation where it's going to be like 5 years later. Later,
right.
You'll get to see Zombie Broads, but you know, it's definitely it'll be coming, and I'm so excited because it's the one thing a theater company wants is their own space. It's a lot of work, it's a lot of things like that, but you don't have to work about anybody's schedule. You can have the time slots you want, and it's your house. It's, you know, like an adult, sometimes you just want to own your own house.
Sure.
As a theater company, you want to own your own house, and so we're just so excited, and we're also rebranding the company. We're going to start pushing some more things. We want to start doing some online video channels and just really start branching ourselves out, and you know, the idea of, you know, make the work. So we're a group of very strong writers and actors and directors and producers, so why not use it to our advantage? So we really want to broaden out what we do and push the envelope even more for what is considered a storefront theater.
So how many people are in that theater company? It sounds like you're doing a lot.
Oh, you know, I honestly
you haven't said the same name twice, so I feel like there's a lot of people doing a lot of stuff.
There is. I mean, I want to say, running down the list in my head, probably around 25 folks.
Okay.
I mean, people have been with that company for the longest time. In fact, which I think was really great, one of our new board members, Jeff Rogers, is actually one of the founding members of the company from back in the day. And he started getting back into it this past couple of years, and when this move came, he was like, jumped on the board, and he was
I can help.
So it's just, yeah, we've got a big group of folks that just, we can cover the gambit of everybody, of all the positions, you know. Carrie Sullivan and Scott Oaken, he's our artistic director, and she's our managing director. They've just been working their back ends off getting this project going, and we, you know, owe so much to them. And Corbett Pasco is our marketing director, and she's been busting her hump, you know, getting the word out there about everything. So we've got some new big stuff coming up soon, and we're, you know, it's going to be one of those things that when it drops, we're just going to be screaming it to the heavens. So if you follow things on social media and you follow us, you're going to hear about it.
You'll know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how we shall know. It will be ready and official, and when we hear our timeline.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I can't wait to hear the timeline myself, because everyone's so excited to jump into this project, because it is so exciting, and it's been so long since something like this happened for us. So everybody's just really biting at the nails to get to it. So we're all just really, really excited. So when it does happen, you will hear a huge scream and holler
scream
and good time.
From the Howard Redline
yes,
stuff.
Absolutely.
Well, I so admire the make the work philosophy.
Absolutely.
Really.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's so important. Not only does it keep your, you know, your skills sharp, but I think there is a decision we all have to kind of make when we enter any industry, and that's even whether it's consciously or subconsciously, about why you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in it just to seek fame and fortune, that's one thing, and that's valid, and good luck to you.
Right.
But I think there's a wonderful group that is that makes up the vast majority of any industry of people who are in it because they love it.
Oh yeah. And if you're not loving it, don't do it.
Don't do it.
And if you feel that, you know, you're really pushing yourself, but you're finding a spot time where you're like, you know what, I want to try something else. Then try something else. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was like, you know what, I want to try writing. I did it a little bit in college. I want to try something. So I'd submitted a script to Wild Claw Theater. They're a horror genre. They just do horror plays. But they do a show every year called Death Scribe, where it's a writing competition for 10-minute horror radio plays. And they do live Foley and stuff like that. And then they get submissions from all over the country, hundreds of them. They whittle them down to 6, and they perform them at the main stage. And they just do a whole show, live band, the whole thing. And they perform them all live on stage with live Foley and things like that. And my goal was like, I'm going to submit to Wild Claw's Death Scribe this year just because I want to try something different. Well, my piece got chosen and went over really well. And it kind of drove me to like, okay, now I want to make some more work. So it keeps you driving forward, which is one reason why I jumped on Cassandra, because it was like, oh, we're writing these every, mm-hmm. oh, great, I can work on that so I can make more work for myself.
Yeah.
And it works nice. I mean, I don't always get paid for it.
Sure,
you know,
it's performing
and entertaining. But there's a lot of things. I've gotten to the point where if I'm doing something like that, it's because I want to do it.
Sure.
I can walk away and at least feel fulfilled with my artistic side and mm-hmm. what I want to do. You
know? Well, and I think creative work breeds other creative work. And so if you're working with a group of 10 people on a project, ideas spin off
quickly and wonderfully and become
huge other things. And I think if you were to, you know, start talking to people in this town about how did this live literary event start and how did this theater event start and how did this play come about? I think if you started having those conversations, you would quickly start hearing about intersections.
Oh yeah.
And ideas colliding. And I don't think there's much of anything anywhere, but especially not in this city creatively, that was just one person had an idea and off it went.
Right. No,
Most things are collisions. It's a teamwork thing.
Yeah. Where, you know, you get to grow up, you meet a few people and we have the same sense of humor. So next, let's go work on this project. And it spreads out, you know, and that's one thing I really love about the community here in Chicago. I was actually talking about it with a friend yesterday, is that the majority of the companies in the community, they're very supportive of each other. They're not shoving you by the face out of the way at the audition because it's my part or we're doing this. For example, I keep talking about, but like the Factory Theater, Wild Claw Theater, Straw Dog Theater, and Lifeline Theater all collaborate together. There's a lot of the same actors in the pools. There's, you know, a lot of the same directors in the pools. They, you know, use each other's spaces and rent for rehearsals or whatever, borrow props. No one's like, no, get away from me. This is I do my thing, and you do your thing. No, it's everybody wants to work together. It's very collaborative, and that's how you keep each other moving, get each other going, and that's how the art happens.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it is because you get together, you work it, and it grows from that. It's not just that one person alone in the basement typing away,
right,
and made this incredible thing. It's, you know, you need 15 other people.
And I think that's kind of been the nature of what's so appealing about Chicago. I think what we've finally caught on to is that people come here for this wonderful community, sharpen their skills, and then they leave.
Mm-hmm.
They go to New York or LA, and we lose all this great talent. We always have new talent coming in.
Oh, absolutely.
But I feel like I'm starting to – finally, we're getting wise to that, and people are starting to do things to keep good talent here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with the shows coming in, with the NBC shows coming in, they're
That's
realizing
huge.
That there's a strong pool here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I called Chicago my grad school of life,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I was able to put the things that I learned in school in process and learn some more from that. But people are starting to realize, I mean – after I moved to Chicago, I started watching TV and watching shows and stuff like that. And I can kind of be like, oh, that person seems like they're from Chicago. Just the style and the way they handle themselves on stage or on camera. It's just a very specific mm-hmm. style that comes out of Chicago. It's very confident. It's very strong. Wonderful character actors come out of here. But yeah, people are starting to realize that there's a lot of talent here in this city. And a lot of times that talent's better than in other places you go, even in LA or New York.
Well, I think that community breeds that kind of confidence.
Oh, yeah.
I think if you know you have, I think you're going to perform differently in front of an audience that has knives pointed at you than it one that's supporting you and wants you to win and wants you to be funny.
Yeah,
it's going to be two very different things. And then there's projects like, I just blanked on the name, the Stage 18, the like filmmakers incubator that's happening through CineSpace.
Oh, I think I've heard about that. Yeah.
That's, you know, that is entirely because Chicagoans said, you know what? I'm sick of losing actors to LA. Mm-hmm. We're going to bring film here and keep it here.
Yeah. And,
they're doing great work.
And it should be. I mean, technically we live in Gotham City. How awesome is that? I mean, this is a beautiful city and why not use it? You know, and you've got the people here. You don't have to go out and track people down and deal with this. They're right here. Everything you need, every style, every look, you've got the talent pool. Might as well just use it and, you know, get these folks some paying jobs so we can, you know, someone
keep them here.
Who wants to make a movie with me? Give me a call.
Let's do this. All right, we're going to take a little break. We're talking with actor Kevin Alvis. We'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Oh, yeah. It's a Holder Nye. 2013 in review. Video Christmas card part 2. Dancing in the front yard night and day, and the neighbors walk by and this is what they say.
Are those Christmas jammies?
They are Christmas jammies.
World.
Check it out. We just bought a Prius V and it matches these.
Well, I haven't heard that song in a hot minute.
I hate the Holderness family. The YouTube sensation Holderness family. I can't stand them.
So why are you playing them?
Because the world needs to know that the Holderness family needs to have YouTube taken away from them.
By increasing demand. Way to go, guy.
You're done with YouTube.
He's just going to blast it in my ears just to show me. Hi there, Amy Guth. You're on 720 WGN. Stop with the Adele. You're killing me with the Adele, Shane. You're killing me with the Adele. God, how funny was that scene on Saturday Night Live?
Oh,
Thanksgiving scene.
I missed it.
Good Lord, it was so funny. It was essentially the family keeps fighting over politics around the Thanksgiving dinner table, and the little child keeps going over to a boombox and just hitting play, and that song starts, and everybody's suddenly like, I'm not going to fight with you about the presidential election. We're going to be friends. And they're singing to each other, and it's beautiful. My friends, we're chatting with actor, comedian, writer, all-around creative dude here in Chicago, Kevin Alvis. He does tons of stuff that you have seen and heard about and you should continue to go to because it is excellent to review every Wednesday at 8 p.m. at the Town Hall Pub via Bruised Orange Theater. He does a show called I Saw You, which I have seen and it is so funny. I dare you. Go and try not to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work. You will laugh so hard you're
You'll
not going to know
mind.
What to do. And then there's Cassandra, mm-hmm. which is a lot of things. It's like written and live lit and performance and lots of things.
Yeah, it's a crazy mishmash, wonderful little sketch show that just I think it's hilarious. The people we work with just have twisted minds that write some wonderful things.
I'm on board, and that's at Hop Leaf.
At the Hop Leaf every last Tuesday at 7:30.
And that show's free.
Totally free. I Saw You's only $5, real cheap. Cassandra's free. You just got to buy, well, you don't have to buy some beer, but why would
it's
you not?
It's a nice gesture.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
You know?
The Hop Leaf would appreciate it.
Jack, our bartender's there.
Sure.
You know, he needs some money.
And then Factory Theater, you and your wife are company members, and Factory Theater has been around for evs.
Yes.
Like 25 or so seasons.
Yeah, something around there.
And you are getting your own theater.
We're getting our own theater. We're so excited.
Up at the Howard Red Line Station. So
yes.
It's right there off Pub Trans. Like,
oh,
I don't
yeah.
even have any excuses. Like, no one's got
no,
any excuses.
And we do some really great stuff. And like I said, those shows we have in the pocket for when we open that the base are just going to be great. And we're going to have so many wonderful opening night parties as well.
Excellent. Those are the ones mm-hmm. to go to. And what's great about Factory Theater in particular is that it's all in-house. It's not like people are writing plays elsewhere in the world and sending them
right.
to you. It's people that we know and work with and ride the L with and people right here in our own community.
Oh, yeah. And they
work,
and they really workshop those to make sure that we're putting out a really great product. Scott Oaken, our artistic director, he requires, you know, you do a write, you get together with company members and you do a reading of it and they give notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back and have a rewrite. Then you have another reading. And then you do rewrites. And I think he even requires one more reading and rewrites before you submit it to even be, you know, considered
yeah.
for the season, because they want to make sure that it fits our format, it fits the Factory life, and we're going to put out a good performance mm-hmm. because so many people will just write a script and hand it over.
Yeah,
but you really got to
work out stuff.
You got to work stuff out.
Everybody needs an editor.
Yeah,
let's not kid ourselves.
And you got to hear it out loud too.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of the sitting around to read is. If you know inside your head, I've written stuff. It's like in my head, I'm like, that is the funniest thing I've ever done. This is going to be hilarious. And then it comes out loud, and it's like, that was the
boy,
dumbest
that was
thing.
Dumb. That didn't work.
Mark that out right there. We're going to do a couple of rewrites.
Crossing that out. Right.
Did not not work at all. So it's a great, I'm glad they have that set up that way. So you can really just get everything down to really nice. You know, we've got some new scripts that are in the works right now. Company member Jill Oliver is writing one that it's going to be hilarious. I've read the like three scenes of the very first rough draft. And I was already like, can I get cast in this show? This is hilarious.
Oh, that's a good sign.
Oh, yeah.
And excellent.
Yeah. And I because I really, I will jump on a show without not knowing much about it, if depending on who wrote it, who's doing it, and who's involved. I will work with, do things that are just because people are in it. Or if companies are with it. You know, I just did a Hobo Junction's a company that I'm friends with, and they do a festival every year called Hobo Robo. And it's a writing competition thing. You write a comedy about the holidays, and it's usually crass and ridiculous. Uh-huh. And they choose the best eight, and they have a writing, they perform them three nights in a row, and the audience chooses their best. And at the end, the writer gets $100, whoever won.
Great.
But I do that because I like those people. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the scripts are, they're all right. But the people involved are so much, it's like, oh, great. Yeah, I'll just come hang out with you for 3 days. You know, yeah, I'll do that show just to hang out with you.
Kind of speaks to what we were saying about the Chicago community, of how it's easy to be here and feel supported creative projects.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my wife and I were very lucky that we knew some people when we first moved here that kind of got us into the community. Mm-hmm. And everybody's just fantastic. Yeah. I mean, so many people, it's just, you know, you don't see them for 6 months and then you see them at an event. It's like, hey, long time. And it's just like old times, yeah.
It's so community driven here around creative projects that when you do encounter a little bit of competition or a little bit of weirdness, it's bold and everybody is surprised by it.
Oh yeah.
People go, whoa, what just happened? What are we doing?
What's your problem?
Where are you from? You're not from here. What are you doing? What's happening?
Do you not know the rule? It's like, yeah.
The rule, we get along here.
We're just going to borrow these props. It's fine.
It's
everybody
fine.
Just calm down.
Don't be weird.
We do it all the time.
It sticks out. It's really stark. And people that come from other markets to here are always commenting. I always hear people going, gosh, everyone's so nice. No one's trying to undermine me here.
Yeah. Which is like, and there's been some people who've come into town. They're like, we're going to shake things up and we're going to be the best. It's like, no, calm down.
No, we got a thing here.
Yeah, we got a thing. We're not like that. Don't be a jerk. And just take it easy.
Everybody be cool.
Be cool.
We will all do our projects.
Yes, because your stuff is completely different than our stuff. So we're not technically in competition. Right. We're just
everybody's
out our
opinion
audiences.
Is valid here. It's all good.
We're all going to the prom. Everybody calm down.
Well, we are out of time almost already. I can't believe it. We've been hanging out with our friend and actor, comedian, writer, creative guy extraordinaire, Kevin Alvis. Go see all the stuff that he does and follow him on social media. Where do we find you?
For me, personally, you can find me at Captain McGee on Twitter. That's my old college pirate name.
Sure.
And then on Facebook as well. And you can also check out Bruised Orange Theater Company at BOTC at Twitter and on Facebook as well. We put up, you know, when and where we'll be. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll do branch out and do a show somewhere else as well. So you can catch that and see who's up. You can catch us Cassandra at Cassandra Comedy on Twitter, also on Facebook. We'll be doing the Chicago Sketch Fest coming up in January. And
excellent.
We're at the Hop Leaf every last Tuesday. We will have a Bruised Orange, I saw he's not doing a show this coming week because of the holiday, but we will be doing a show on the 30th right before New Year's Eve, so you can kind of come pre-party, and then Cassandra will also have a show that week too, so you can pre-party for the New Year's, and then Factory, you can follow at the Factory Theater on Twitter and on Facebook, because that's when we'll be announcing our dates for our new space.
And the brand new, your very own theater comes
up. Yeah, and you can come check out for our Kickstarter for that. We do personalized thank you videos. Each company members get together and do personalized, and they're hilarious. So if you just want to watch some silly videos too, come find the Factory. It's
sounds
fun.
All right, so much. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank
Kevin
you
Alvis, big fan of yours. Everybody, go follow him, find him. I'll tweet all these things out. So you can, if you follow me on Twitter, I will direct you to him and follow him and connect with him and go to all the stuff that he does, because it's all good.
Hooray.
All right, we're going to take a break and get you to news on 720 WGN.